Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Cambridge Savings Bank. CSB is committed to improving the financial well-being of local small businesses through financial education and banking services. Learn more at cambridgesavings.com, member FDIC. And Safety Insurance, offering auto insurance policies designed to help for when the worst happens. You can ask an independent agent about safety insurance. Safety Insurance. We'll help you manage life's storms.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi warned of President Trump's disassociation from reality, as she calls it, in a press conference where she announced the plan to look into whether he's capable of continuing his duties or should face removal from office. In a few minutes, we'll open the lines to get your views.
At noon, we'll talk to Boston Mayor Marty Walsh about the city's decision to postpone any further in-school learning as COVID-19 infection rates rise. We'll also take your calls and questions for the mayor coming up ahead on Boston Public Radio. GBH. Happy Friday, Jim.
Hey there, and that's Mardrigan wearing an apron as the show starts, which I assume means we'll be smelling the muffins.
Tuna fish, just the Jim. Tuna I was fish. Making tuna fish.
You look fetching.
That's my specialty.
Say. So on Monday, when Dr. Sean Conley announced that President Trump was going to be discharged from Walter Reed, the medical community responded with skepticism, with concern for a man who had been on supplemental oxygen, a mix of drugs and therapeutic treatments. Returning the president to the White House seemed premature. However, to witness Trump's, I think you can call it, steroidal manic high, it's no wonder they wanted him out of Walter Reed. It is astonishing that he has actually managed to out-Trump himself. Listen to this list, Marjorie. It started with calling off the stimulus negotiations, then hours later, sort of reinstating them or attempting to. He told Americans to not let coronavirus dictate their lives as the death toll surpassed 200,000. He called off the second presidential debate. He blamed Gold Star families for infecting him with coronavirus. He called on Bill Barr to indict Biden and Obama. He called Kamala Harris a communist and a monster. He minted $100 coins commemorating his triumph over COVID. He tweeted that he was bringing home troops from Afghanistan by Christmas so that we would be prepared for war with Russia and China. He lashed out at Governor Whitmer in Michigan for not thanking him after the federal government charged 13 people with conspiring to kidnap her in an alleged domestic terror plot. All of this has happened in 1 week, in a span actually of just a few days. It's a behavior that has compelled Nancy Pelosi to introduce legislation to create a commission under the Constitution, by the way, that would allow Congress to oust President Trump or any president under appropriate circumstances, using a provision in the 25th Amendment. We're taking your calls at 877-301-8970. Do you support what Pelosi is doing? Is this a good precedent to have, not just for Trump, but for future leaders? In the short term, obviously, it seems like a partisan move. Long term, is this the way of protecting the nation? Or are you with Mitch McConnell, who says the whole thing is absolutely absurd? What are you laughing about? What are you laughing about?
Well, I mean,
the list?
Yeah, but there are a few other things I'd like to add.
Go right ahead.
The president, calling himself a perfect specimen, said he's very, very young.
He is.
He also said that Nancy Pelosi was trying to stage a coup against him. Pelosi said he's in an altered state. He says Crazy Nancy is the one that should be under observation.
But that's not that atypical. That is like fairly common behavior about him and Nancy Pelosi.
Okay, well, not usually that someone should be under observation for a mental health problem.
Did you hear him on the – I didn't hear it live, but hear him on Fox News. I think it was with Marie Bartiromo, whatever her name is. I think it was on that show.
She was trying to get out of the interview.
He's yelling. He's upset with his own Barr and Pompeo. Well, let's just play some sound. Here is this. It was the call to Fox business.
Right.
He's complaining that not enough of his political enemies have been arrested. Listen to the president.
Unless Bill Barr indicts these people for crimes, the greatest political crime in the history of our country, then we're going to get little satisfaction unless I win, and we'll just have to go because I won't forget it. But these people should be indicted. This was the greatest political crime in the history of our country, and that includes Obama and it includes Biden. These are people that spied in my campaign, and we have everything. Now they say they have much more, okay? And I say, Bill, we got plenty. You don't need any more. We got so much, Maria.
So he's essentially saying to his attorney general, you got what you need. If not, I'll give you more. And you can prosecute. By the way, the people he's talking about are, in that case, Biden and Obama. And he's upset with his Secretary of State, Pompeo, because he's not proceeding in some fashion on, you may have heard of these before, the Clinton emails. And by the way, you didn't comment on the other one, that it's getting no play.
What?
He wants to withdraw all troops from Afghanistan,
right,
which may be a good idea, by the way, by Christmas, for other reasons, so that we can be prepared if there's a war with China or Russia. Only in this presidency could that get no attention. The number is 877-301-8897. Can I explain one more thing?
Yep.
The 25th Amendment, Section 4, which we talked to you about at some length the other day, is a provision that has never been used. Section 3 has been used, you know, when a president is under general anesthesia. I think it's been used three times, and maybe four. I'm not sure in American history. Section 4 says if they're unable to fulfill their duties, and there are two methods to get there. The vice president, and I think it's a majority of the cabinet, I'm not sure, but they're all obviously loyal to the president. The other thing's a body created by Congress. Jamie Raskin in 2017, he's a congressman from Maryland, proposed creating such a body so that it's ready for action if it's needed, whether it's because of steroids or because the president is mentally unable or in some other fashion unable to fulfill his or her duties. That went nowhere. This one's going to go nowhere, too. But that's the motivation, so that Congress is ready as it should be. I don't care who the president is, if he or someday she is unable to do their duties and refuses to voluntarily relinquish power under Section 3.
And I just want to point out one other thing. We're going to talk about this later with Emily Rooney, but I can't resist pointing it out now. We're going to have the Supreme Court hearings next week. Amy Coney Barrett, who has indicated in her previous statements and writings that she is could overturn Roe v. Wade. One of the big things the pro-life group has been campaigning against, and the Trump administration did it, was to stop federal funding last year for this research involving fetal tissue. And the cocktail of monoclonal antibodies that the president described as a cure was, of course, developed using human cells derived from fetal tissue. And many of the other vaccines that are under investigation are also linked to fetal tissue. So I guess the bottom line is
what's good for the goose is not good for the gander.
Yeah. He's stopping federal funding for fetal tissue, but he himself is using medications that came from fetal tissue. So it's kind of like, you know, I don't want these women to get abortions, but if abortions help me get a cure for my COVID, then I'm all for it.
We'll get into that a little bit more with Emily at 11:30 or 11:35. 877-301-8970. Again, that whole list that I just went through, and Marjorie added a little, was from two or three days. And it seems to me that Congress should at least have the mechanism in place to make decisions about whether or not a president, any president, can do this. The unfortunate thing is it's happening in the middle of an election season, but he took the steroids in the middle of an election season. And by the way, even if you think Trump is aberrational all the time, which he is, I think we would all agree, his supporters would agree, it's one of the reasons they love him. This is the most intense, and I would argue scary, several days I've ever seen from this
president.
I read
this story last night. I don't know when I read it, 10 o'clock, 10:30, 11 o'clock, the New York Times story
that
laid all this out.
Yeah.
And I think I texted or I emailed you. I thought, this is the craziest thing I've read in my life about the presidency. Way down in it was a story about Mitch McConnell. Said he hasn't been to the White House since August 6th because he's so worried
about the COVID protocols at the White House.
And I mean, Matt, the White House is now a viral hotspot for COVID. So you wonder. I was listening to my favorite podcast, The Daily, this morning. They did a really good piece about people in Pennsylvania, a lot of coal miners, people that voted for Barack Obama twice and voted for Trump because of jobs and all this kind of stuff. And it's going to be a swing state. But a lot of these people, none of this matters. You know, all that they care about is the fact that, and you understand why, because if your jobs are in jeopardy, they think the Democrats have abandoned them and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's like a totally different universe. And I think we forget that sometimes, that there's this universe which knows about this stuff and worries about this stuff. And then there's people like those people that were interviewed in Pennsylvania who are just, we don't care. Unemployment was low. Work in the mines was better, even though it's not so great. And that's all we care about.
Well, there's one other thing, if we can, and then we'll get to the coals. As a former Pennsylvanian myself, I lived the first 21 years of my life, it's not just what you mentioned. They also want to be ready for war with Russia and China. So, Pennsylvania, I mean, really? Amy in Cambridge, you are first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome. Hi.
Well, hi there, Jim and Marjorie. It's nice to talk with you today.
You too.
Thanks. Before I speak to Nancy Pelosi, I just wanted to ask Marjorie and everybody else on the planet, instead of calling the pro-life people, the self-proclaimed pro-life people, pro-life, please call them anti-choice. Because they are not pro-life when it comes to detaining children at the border, when it comes to taking care of women after they give birth, and taking care of their families. And I really would like you to consider that.
Well, you know, Amy, let me explain to you why I don't do that. It's because their group is proclaimed, this is what they want to be called. They want to be called pro-life. The pro-choice people want to be called pro-choice. It was a long time debate in journalism whether you should call people anti-abortion, pro-abortion. Pro-choice people didn't like that because who's really pro-abortion? It's not a pleasant thing. Obviously, it's a tragic thing for lots of people. So that's why I do it. I think it's just that's what they want to be called. That's what they want to be called. Same thing with the pro-choice side.
But having said that, what's your other point, Amy?
The explication. Yeah, this just briefly about McConnell saying that about the White House, that he wouldn't go to the White House to those because those people don't wear masks. Mm-hmm. That was a signal to all the Republicans to say, you distance yourself from this president.
But they didn't. But they haven't. But they haven't.
No, but I think Susan Collins is certainly trying up in Maine.
Yeah.
And I suspect that, and at any rate, that's all this, about Pelosi.
Yeah.
I think this is the worst idea ever, because this guy is going to hang himself. You know that the Congress isn't going to remove him from office. You know that the cabinet won't. And it's a complete distraction from the election that is coming up. I recognize he remains a greater danger to this country than any foe outside of our borders.
Well, Amy, can I explain to you what I think from what I've read that Pelosi is all about? I'm not saying you're wrong strategically. Is one, she's a good vote counter. She knows, number one, it's not going to pass Congress and be signed by the president. Two, even if it were, we're 3.5 weeks from an election, it's not going to happen. However, she believes, whether you agree or not, that it really helps the base get energized with 3.5 weeks of the election. So it's less a policy matter, even though as a policy matter, I totally agree with it. Timing may be bad, but rather a presidential strategic and Senate strategic move. So we'll see. Amy, thank you for all your points. 877-301-8970. And by the way, is it the Cook Report? Is that what it's called? Does the estimates of...
Yes, I think so.
They are suggesting the Democrats in the House could pick up as many as 15 seats. Obviously, they have a pretty significant majority now. And they have been converting, we're going to talk about one of them later, a number of races that were leaning Republican, either toss-ups or leaning Democratic in the United States Senate. But we'll get to that a little later in the day. Let's go to Cohasset, where Laura is on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Laura.
Hi there. How are you?
Excellent.
Both.
Good.
So my one comment is that I had to renew my driver's license online this week, And one of the questions is, are you taking any medication that would affect your ability to drive? We know that dexamethasone has the side effect of mania. So how on earth is a person qualified to run a country, much less a car, on medications known to affect thinking? I just think it's basic for the time that he's on these medications, he should transfer power to his vice president.
Well, you know what's even more obvious to me? I couldn't agree with you more, by the way. And by the way, it would be temporary, a la I'm under general anesthesia, so while I am, you, Mr. Vice President, are the acting president. What's more unbelievable is this is yet another example, and I say this with complete confidence in being right, that a sycophantic doctor is allowing Donald Trump to dictate what he should say. This Conley guy is as disgraceful as that hippie in New York City, the guy who used to be his doctor, who allowed Trump to dictate his own health letter when he was running for the presidency.
Yeah, didn't he say he was the most healthy person ever to have taken office in the history of the United States or something like that?
Go ahead, Laura. You can continue.
I was just going to say that, yes, he's brought down these institutions from Walter Reed to FDA. I mean, I used to work in writing applications to FDA, and they are brilliant scientists. Much of the industry doesn't like them because they push back, but that's their job. And now I wouldn't trust FDA with the decision on these vaccines. They've all been tainted.
The FDA did push back the other day, at least on this two-month monitoring thing, which meant that Donald Trump would not be able to say that a vaccine would be approved before the election, not for political reasons, the FDA, but exactly the opposite, because that's the only way to do it safely. I would say he's part of the problem on that front. I think the utter capitulation, more often than not, by people like Redfield at the CDC, the guy who runs the FDA, they're the ones who have a lot of apologizing. And Dr. Birx, on the other hand, there is Dr. Fauci. Laura, thank you very much for the call. Did you happen to watch, Mar? Did you see Bill Gates on with Anderson Cooper last night?
No, I missed it.
Let me tell you, it is so... I've probably seen him talk maybe 10 times ever, except this is like maybe a 25-minute interview, all about COVID and related things. And it was so... And he was paying tribute to Fauci almost nonstop. It was so refreshing to see somebody really smart who really cares about this issue, not just the impact on the United States, but around the world, and who is obviously putting his money big time, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where his mouth is. It's if people didn't see it, I'm sure it's online. It's worth spending 20 minutes of your life watching.
Record Anderson Cooper so I can watch it later, Jim, at my leisure.
Fine. 877-301-8970. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Ted in New Hampshire. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Ted.
Hello there, first-time caller.
Thank you.
Thank
I've been
you.
A primary care physician in New Hampshire for over 37 years, just retired in March, no coincidence. And what I'm seeing is that the increasing irrational behavior that we're seeing the last week or so from our president could certainly be a result of his medical condition. First of all, we know that coronavirus can cause cognitive dysfunction and brain fog, and we also know that steroids, which he did receive in the hospital and may still be receiving, can cause a common condition called steroid psychosis, which I've seen many times in patients of mine. And I think when you superimpose this on his underlying personality, I think it's a very dangerous situation. And I hope that his physicians are watching him closely and that the rest of the people around him are being prepared to take some steps other than just from the Democratic side to limit his ability to make potentially dangerous decisions when he's medically compromised.
Well, you know, remember back, Ted, during Watergate, when apparently President Nixon was drinking heavily, there was some, the Joint Chiefs and other people were very concerned. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, correct if I'm wrong, Jim, there was some discussion among the Joint Chiefs about the nuclear codes. So obviously I have no idea what's going on with the president now, but I hope that those people who are worried about that sort of thing have made some kind of similar agreement among themselves. That's what I'm hoping. Because, I mean, you know, even Donald Trump, it goes a little far.
How can you say agreement amongst themselves when you see Dr. Conley's performance?
Well, he's not a doctor. I'm talking about the military.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's what I'm talking about. Because even for Donald Trump, it goes a little far to say, I'm really young and I'm a perfect specimen. I'm, you know, I think he'd say that if he weren't a little bit, you know, over the edge on the steroids. Do you think, Dr. Ted from New Hampshire?
Well, he absolutely could be, and we've become so accustomed to these outrageous statements that we've become immune to them or numb to them, and they just get progressively more outrageous, and, you know, we're sort of the boiled frogs who no longer react to anything anymore.
Now, Ted, before you go away, I want you to make sure you reserve some time tonight, because according to the Daily Beast, the president will have a medical evaluation on Fox News tonight. Fox News is confirming that Dr. Mark Siegel will conduct a medical evaluation and interview. Oh my God! During the program, Ted, we're really glad you called, and we hope you do it again soon. Now, Marjorie, we were going to take a break, but I think you're going to want to hear from Alice and Newton. Let's slip her in before the break. Alice, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for calling. You have a connection to something we're talking about?
Yes, I do, and I've thought about this a long time, whether to try to put this on the radio.
Okay.
But yes, I was married to Dr. Harold Bornstein.
Oh.
Yes. Yes, Marjorie, I was. I'm wife number one.
Mm-hmm.
He's now married to his third wife. But I just couldn't let this go by any longer. When I knew him, he was really cared about his patients, and he was actually a good doctor. So I can only assume that the famous letter that was written, he was just once again falling under the spell. I can also say something else. He
Please.
Was an expert typist. So there were some typos in that letter, which also kind of seemed strange. So that's basically it. That's why I called in.
Well, Alice, don't go away. We really appreciate your finally getting to this point. What's your speculation, since obviously you knew him quite well, as to why he would allow a presidential candidate to dictate, assuming he did type it, dictate a letter, which is pretty important.
It's ironic because his mother used to run that office, and she had since passed away before that whole letter incident. But I guarantee if his mother had been living at that time, I don't think he would have done it. I think he was in awe of celebrity, so to speak. And that's all I can think of, because when I knew him, he really, really was a reasonable, good doctor.
Alice,
I mean, he had his quirks.
Alice, it seems as though dozens of people that you would have thought would know better have fallen under, as you put it, his spell. I mean, I'll give the president this. He seems to – he's a master manipulator, and he's a guy who really gets what he wants. And people have said he can be very, very charming and very much – you know, so I can see where he might have been swept up, because he's not the only one, you know?
Right. Now, this was 40 – you know, I'm doing the math. So I was married to him when I was, you know, divorced at 31, and I'm 72 now. So it's been a long time. I just sort of wanted one person to say he wasn't a terrible person.
Alice, is really good. But don't go away. I have one last question for you. I know this is speculative. Had you been married to him when this happened, do you think you would have done it?
I don't think I had any influence. We had we did not have a normal marriage, I would say, because during the whole time we were married, he was in medical school and an internship and residency. So we didn't spend as much time together as, a lot of marriages do, especially in the early days. I was extremely close to his mother. I absolutely adored her. And I'm extremely close to his cousin. I adore her. So I'm still close with members of the family.
Alice, we're really...
All I can say, except... I just wanted to defend him just a little bit.
We're really, really glad you called, Alice. Thank you for making that decision. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And when we certainly use the word hippie, we're not using it in a disparaging way. Because I thought, weren't you quite the little hippie, Jim, when you were young?
Well, I might
Didn't
have been.
Didn't you go the tie-dye route and all that
I might have.
Kind of stuff?
I can't remember that far back.
Strawberry
but I might
fields,
have.
But et cetera.
Let me just say, and the reason we described him as hippie, because he looks in his, whenever, 60s or 70s, he looks hippie-ish. But in any case, that was great. Alice
was
from
great.
Newton, former wife of Dr. Bornstein and of Trump fame.
Okay, we're talking about President Trump asking you if it's time for Congress or somebody to intervene. Nancy Pelosi sure thinks so. Do you? We're going to keep talking about this at 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about President Trump's behavior since he left Walter Reed, which Nancy Pelosi is describing, quote, as a disassociation from reality. In response to Trump's behavior the last few days, she and Jamie Raskin from Maryland have introduced legislation to give Congress a role under the 25th Amendment in determining whether any president of the U.S. needs to be forced out of office, at least temporarily, because he or she is incapable of doing the job. And we're asking if this is a dangerous precedent or one that's long overdue. And I would make up one other request. Alice from Newton, who made a wonderful call, she was Dr. Bornstein's first wife. And Dr. Bornstein is the guy who wrote had the letter dictated to him by Donald Trump about how healthy he was. If Dr. Bornstein's second or third wives are listening, we would really appreciate if they were I'm kidding. It's great that Alice called in. 877-301-8970. Can I just play briefly? Here is Jamie Raskin at the press conference this morning with Nancy Pelosi explaining why they're doing this at this time.
The situation has focused everybody's mind on the need for following through on this suggestion in the 25th Amendment that Congress set up its own body. And I think, again, in the age of COVID-19, where a lot of government actors have been afflicted by it, we need to act.
So there's Jamie Raskin, again, the lead sponsor of this bill.
So I just have an email from Dan, who seems to have some experience with the effects of steroids. He says, one of the good is how after a day or two, all the aches of an older man go away, so much so you could feel you could lift a car up with one hand and change the tire with the other. Maybe we should try some, Jim. The bad is the emotional effect long-term use can affect decision-making. Dan wonders if the president might be hooked on them. I have no idea. But that does seem to make sense, what Dan is saying.
And what Ted, the doctor from New Hampshire.
I mean, it's all of this. It's standing on the balcony of the White House like he was Mussolini or something in this bizarre staged press moment, which he had filmed by his personal, well, it's not his personal, but the White House people that do those things, photographers, et cetera. And then the other press, then the little moment he appeared in the White House, remember he had much more orange on the bottom of his face than he had on the top of his face? Did you notice that one? It was kind of like he was two-colored. All these odd things he seems to be doing.
I like the bi-colored look, actually. That's just one person's opinion. Charles in Concord, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me. Love your show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Love your show.
Thanks.
I was actually hospitalized on February 12th and rushed to the ICU at Brigham's for spinal meningitis, monococcal. It's a very rare form of meningitis, which I do believe was related to COVID. I had all the symptoms, loss of taste, loss of smell, but the tests weren't available at the time. My family actually was able to come up from New York and visit me. I mean, that's how early this was in the pandemic. There was only one other case here in Massachusetts that was certified, but I never once did anybody mention COVID. But however, I was administered dexamethasone. I was unconscious for 3 days. I woke up surrounded by family, couldn't speak. I was there maybe for a total of 1 week. And I mean, to this day, I'm still suffering from some symptoms, mostly brain fog. However, that dexamethasone, I was flying. I mean, I couldn't speak, but I couldn't sleep. And that's the other thing that I hear Donald Trump talking about. Just could not sleep. I mean, they put me on all kinds of stuff, Haldol, Trazodone, and it just wouldn't take me out. I mean, I'd maybe get like 1 hour. Of course, emergency rooms are, or ICUs are pretty bad places to sleep in general. But my parents afterwards, they were taking care of me, and they were like, stop cleaning. I just could not stop cleaning the house.
Wow. And how? I mean, and this was while you were actively taking it, or did this continue even after you stopped?
So they injected me to reduce the swelling. I also have asthma. They injected me, and I woke up 3 days later. They didn't continue to give me injections for that. I guess it's like six times stronger than prednisone, and I also have an adverse reaction to prednisone. Every time I've been given prednisone for asthma, I mean, I start gardening. I start doing all kinds of things, like, you know, normally. It's just out of control, but that's the manic symptom. The doctors at the neuro ICU actually told me, they're like, we think you're experiencing mania. My wife is a clinical health psychologist, and she said the same exact thing. So, I mean, she knows me best.
Charles,
I even recognized it. I mean,
Charles, thanks for sharing your experience.
That's a fascinating call. You know, what I also read this morning, that dexamethasone is usually given in COVID cases when people are very sick, sometimes already on a ventilator.
Bill Gates made that point last night. That's what he said he found strange.
Coma.
Yep.
So that's one of the reasons that we may not know so much about this mania stuff, because the people that get it, obviously they're not going to be able to be manic when they're in a coma. Anyway.
Thank you for your calls.
Up next, we are going to talk to Emily Rooney. She's here for her famous list of assertions, assignations, fixations, and fulminations. Emily Rooney next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. Emily Rooney is here for her famous list of fixations and fulminations and more. She's the host of Beat the Press, which you can catch right here Friday nights on GBH2 at 7 o'clock. Hello, Emily Rooney.
Hey, Marjorie, Jim. How are you?
We're good.
Hey, Emily Rooney. So let's start with the governor out in Michigan. Apparently a plot against her that was been hatched for many, many months now. 13 people arrested and indicted, and they were going to kidnap her and put her on trial for opening up.
Put her on trial. This is where you really have to give the FBI and law enforcement credit, because they thwarted this scheme, which I guess had been going on for several months. They arrested 13 people. And, they were going to kidnap her. They were going to put her on trial. The shocking thing about this is that I was doing some research this morning. There are so many of these groups. They are virtually in every single state in the country, including our own. You know, there's these rabid anti-government people, mostly middle-aged or white men, who feel, you know, that the government has overtaken, has disrupted their lives, or has intruded too much into their lives. And in this case, the thing that sparked them was that Governor Whitmer had imposed some fairly, you know, stringent rules and regulations regarding COVID, like most governors did, like our governor did, like our governor still is. But there were violent protests against those months ago. And I guess this scheme was hatched then.
I want to talk about those protests in a second. And by the way, in reaction to those original shutdowns by Governor Whitmer, that's what prompted the Capitol letter tweet from the president, Liberate Michigan.
Yes.
Here is Governor Whitmer yesterday tying the kidnapping attempt against her to the president's rhetoric about white supremacy.
When our leaders speak, their words matter. They carry weight. When our leaders meet with, encourage, or fraternize with domestic terrorists, they legitimize their actions, and they are complicit.
And after these guys are arrested for alleged kidnapping, and who knows what else or what worse, the president, of course, does what he does best. He trashed Governor Whitmer. But can I go back to your...
Let me just add, you know who called her is Governor Charlie Baker.
I know that.
Yesterday.
Yeah, that was
really
great.
She gave him a shout-out last night on CNN. I thought, that's a classy move.
So I couldn't agree more. And by the way, it didn't just impress Whitmer. The former Governor Granholm tweeted about Baker having called. I thought it was great. But I want to go back to what you said, the original demonstrations. I didn't know till last night, even though it didn't surprise me, there are only two states in the United States that are dumb enough, backward enough, and vicious enough to allow citizens to carry weapons into the state house. I don't know what the second one is.
Oh.
So, Michigan is one of them.
Yeah,
and, you know, as I was listening to Lieutenant Governor, whose name I can't remember, from Michigan last night, he made the most obvious point that it's true. There is no reason to bring weaponry into a state house other than, one, to do harm or to intimidate, physically intimidate elected officials. The fact that the legislature there allows this is just it is beyond scandalous. It is almost homicidally scandalous. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable.
So there was all this debate this morning about whether this was an act of domestic terrorism and whether the media should have been using that term. But, I mean, the law enforcement called it terrorism. Mm-hmm. But, I don't know whether adding domestic or is that an issue? I mean –
I don't think so. Yeah. Terrorism is meant to terrorize.
Was this an act of terrorism? I'd say yes, it was. Right?
I would.
Yeah.
You know, one last thing about this
message to public officials.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
Even though this is horrifying, it's sort of like everybody looks at everything through their own, you know, local prism. And as I'm sitting watching, I didn't know about the Baker call, which I agree with you is terrific, to Widmer. But imagine if it happened here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you imagine? Forget the governor herself or the governor himself here, living through this. And I assume every governor in America who did the responsible thing, like Whitmer, like Baker, like all these other people, I assume this morning have to have extra protection so that they're not in these nuts are not inspired by these 13 people there.
There is something particularly odious about the fact that it was a woman that they were going after.
Absolutely.
Great point.
I mean, there's this psychosexual – the whole thing was just
not a coincidence,
creepy. Yeah, exactly.
I would say.
Exactly.
And also, what were they exactly planning on doing? They were going to take her to some remote location
exactly.
for a quote-unquote trial.
Yeah.
Apparently, they were staking out her summer home and figuring out the best way that they could pull off this heist.
Again, kudos to law enforcement. And
there's
got to be more of these.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Emily Rooney, we talked about this a little bit earlier with listeners, but I'm wondering if Mike Pence, who wears his faith on his sleeve and he's a proud pro-lifer, is going to be able to take the vaccine. Since we learned from reading these stories that many of these vaccines under consideration, not to mention the medications that the president has taken himself, have come from fetal cells from abortion.
Well, they originally derived – well, the one that President Trump took the Regeneron. Was apparently derived from an abortion sometime in the 1970s. But Regeneron now says – that they are hamster cells, but the original cells, they admit, came from a fetus. So whether they are now, that's questionable. But a lot of this kind of medical intervention starts with fetal material. I mean, you can debate whether that's the right thing or not, but at least, I mean, you know, I don't want to have a whole discussion about abortion, but at least you can argue that the material goes to something useful.
You know, I was quoting from a wonderful interview that Anderson Cooper, Emily, did last night with Bill Gates.
Oh, I saw it.
About COVID in general. But what I had forgotten about was he was asked about this fetal cell thing.
Yes.
And Gates, in an act of stunning naivete, said, well, but since the what they called threads or strings or whatever they are decades old, it's not really an issue. As if it is
ridiculous.
Not, that of course it is. Yeah. But let me say a few more things about it. Let's hear Trump. When Trump was talking about Regeneron, this is, I think, out on the White House lawn. Here's the president a day or so ago.
I went in, I wasn't feeling so hot, and within a very short period of time, they gave me Regeneron. It's called Regeneron. And it was like unbelievable. I felt good immediately. I felt as good 3 days ago as I do now. These, I view these, and now they call them therapeutic, but to me, it wasn't therapeutic. It just made me better. Okay, I call that a cure.
Well, first of all, it is not a cure, as Mr. Gates and others made clear last night. Two, the implication was, in what he said further, is that other COVID sufferers are going to be the beneficiaries of this. We know that's not the case, at least in the near future, because of its unavailability.
Oh, yeah. Well, it acts like everybody's a chump for not getting it or not being.
Do you know what a dose?
You
know? Do either of you know what one dose? What a dose of? Well, the appropriate dose,
it's
whatever.
Like $850 or something.
$96,731 for the full regimen of Regeneron, and that's going to be available.
I wonder how much he paid for that.
Well, but he should. I mean, in all fairness, I don't begrudge any treatment that he got.
I don't begrudge anybody getting anything for free when it comes to
exactly.
COVID.
And the president probably should. But the issue is suggesting that, exactly. Don't worry, I got it.
Exactly.
You're all going to be safe.
You're all going to get it. Exactly. Just get out your checkbooks.
By the way, the excuse that one official from the Trump administration gave to the New York Times about that when they pointed out the hypocrisy of his administration stopping federal funding on a fetal tissue in 2019 was that the administration said it was okay to use fetal tissue made before June 2019. So if you're going to be pro-life, I don't know how using older fetal tissue to get you out of
it's illogic. I can't help you with, Marjorie.
And it will also be interesting to see what they do about the vaccine.
Well, that's kind of what Bill Gates was saying too. That as long as it's decades old, it's like I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that matters. And one last thing about this, you know, the president. I don't know if he's ever had a beer, but he doesn't drink.
No.
And I presume maybe that – I think he said it has
he's
to do
a dry
with
his brother.
He had
wasn't
an
it?
Alcohol
yeah.
problem.
Yeah, and his father.
So if you're somebody that never drinks and doesn't take drugs, you know, why – some people drink because they want to get a buzz on and feel better. Some people take drugs oftentimes because they want to feel better. I'm interested about the angle of his not having done that. Maybe he just – you know, I think other people that have done drugs or drink a lot would know that drugs alter your state of consciousness.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some naivete in him about
that's
this
what a lot
thing.
Of people are saying that in the last 72 hours that he's nuttier than ever been, if that's possible, and it could be from the drugs he's taken.
Well, that's how we started the show today. Yeah. So, Emily, we had a wonderful conversation, sort of a public service announcement kind of conversation the other day about what to do in lieu of traditional Halloween in cities like Leicester and Lawrence and a few others that have canceled Halloween. And you told Marjorie this morning about what happens to your neighbor. Before you do the two of you know that Charlie Baker went out of his way the other day to say what a horrible idea a statewide cancellation of Halloween would be? Mm-hmm. Because his concern, which I hadn't thought about at all when we had that conversation, Marjorie, is if you cancel traditional Halloween, he said it should be left to cities and towns, by the way, he wasn't saying go wild. His concern, which is totally legit, is everything moves indoors. And if it moves indoors, it's even more dangerous.
I know.
So what's happened in your neighborhood in the past?
Yeah, so they shut down parts of the Back Bay, Marlboro Street from Arlington all the way up to Mass Ave, or maybe it ends at Gloucester. I'm not quite sure. But thousands and thousands of kids come into that street and in neighborhoods on Beacon Hill as well, areas where they shut, I mean, literally thousands. Mm. And everybody sits on their front stoops, you know, with thousands of pieces of candy. Everybody hands it out. I was telling Marjorie, groups come by, you know, in the hundreds, stacks of them. If your stoop is packed, they move on to the next stoop. And it's really beautiful. My neighbors, the Cashmans, do this haunted house every year with live actors in their yard. People come from all over to see it. That cannot happen. They are shoulder to shoulder. They're, you know, peering their faces into your, you know, candy baskets. I know for one, I loved it. I've sat out there every year for the past 16 years. I can't do it this year. They haven't made any. Maybe you'll ask the mayor about it in the next segment. I don't know if it's up to him, by the way. I think the Back Bay Association is the one who decides whether to shut the streets and that kind of thing. But I don't know how they can do it. I don't know how they can rearrange it.
But they have to do something. I agree with you. And we will ask the mayor. I didn't have it on my list, but I will add it. It's a wonderful point. I don't know if he can mandate something. Well, he could.
I don't know if he can.
Well, I think he could as a public health. Well, we'll ask him in a couple of minutes. So are they not closing the streets?
Well, they haven't announced it. And usually they put up this little sign. Well, like in another week, they would put up a little sign that shows you exactly what streets are blocked off, when you can get in and out of your if you park on the street. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't. I mean, your car would be locked in, or if even some of the alleys are inaccessible. So, you know, we should know within a week or so, but I just can't see how it's going to happen.
So speaking of cancer, I'm sorry, go ahead.
They're selling these Halloween bags. I mentioned this the other day with the really long handles. Like
I love
stick.
That.
Yeah,
so you can kind of go out with your bag and you can be 6 feet away from the
apparently
from the
a face mask is the latest costume too. And the face mask costume costs $70. It's like, what?
Wow.
Anyway, I know.
Wow.
Crazy.
Some people, I'm not advocating for this, I want to be clear. Some people are suggesting you just take dexamethasone and just go out and screw it. You know, not worry. Yeah. Okay, so she's here for a lot of reasons, but particularly for this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
I think we skipped it last week.
No. We did, because of Trump's COVID. So.
Oh, that's what it was. So thank goodness it's back.
But I liked the intro. You added a few new designations and what?
That was Marjorie.
Perfect.
She's in an apron today. It's really inspired her.
All right. So, presidential debates. I went back and I did a little research on this, and my list today is: Can you remember? And I'll be honest and to say right off the bat, there was only a couple of these things I actually remembered. But then when I went back and looked at it, it was like, oh my gosh, remember that?
I'm so excited.
Here we go.
About this.
Can you remember the name of the moderator for the first 1960 Nixon-Kennedy debate?
Howard K. Smith.
Excellent, Jim.
Thank you very much.
Jim.
I did not remember that. And that's a good thing.
In all fairness, watched a piece of it a week ago. That's the only I would never have known.
I had no idea.
I watched it last week.
All right. So that was 1960. Can you remember what year the next presidential debates took place after 1960?
Well, obviously that means it wasn't 64.
68?
68. Had to be.
Nope.
72?
Nope.
76?
Yep.
What happened?
Carter v. Ford. Well, there was nobody really in charge, which is another thing I'll get to in a minute. But there was nobody really insisting on it. And there was, I think, remember Don Hewitt? I think he was one of the guys behind
the original debate.
He was just making good television. Nobody, you know, there was no mandates about it. All right. So as long as we're on the 1976, what dramatic event do you remember happened?
I do. That's when the New York Times guy, after Gerald Ford said there's no Soviet dominate. That wasn't it?
No.
Oh, it was 1980? Oh, that was 1980.
No, we're still on 1976.
Okay, that was, I don't know.
That was a dramatic moment. And Gerald said there's no Soviet domination
in
Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
No,
this wasn't a debate, but that was the year when Reagan said about I pay for this microphone.
The first debate.
What was it?
The first debate. That wasn't a presidential debate, Marjorie.
Okay.
The audio cut out for 27 minutes, and the two candidates stood on stage for 27 minutes in silence. I remember this now. It was still on TV. I was sitting with my father going, I can't believe this is unbelievable. And then they came back in time for the closing statements.
No.
Yes.
Really?
All right. The next one's a bit of a trick question.
76.
Yeah, but is Carter and who?
Ford.
Ford.
All right. Next one's a trick question.
I forgot that, too. Oops.
Wait, I might have the wrong. Anyway.
By the way, it was 76. But the no Soviet domination had to be 76.
It was.
Okay, fine.
And so was that one.
Go ahead.
The silence.
Okay.
All right. Who was on stage for the first 1980 presidential debate? And I'll give you a hint. It was the year Carter ran against Reagan.
John Anderson.
And?
Oops. Jill Stein.
No, I had forgotten this. Carter refused to debate Ronald Reagan if John Anderson was on the stage. Reagan refused to debate if Carter was not there. The first debate was Reagan and John Anderson.
It was?
Yes. The second debate was canceled, and the third was Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter, where Reagan blew him out of the water. I know. It was just the two of them.
That is great.
All right. This is another good one. Do you remember what shocking question
resurrected
Bernie Shaw asked George Herbert Walker Bush in 1988? All right, everybody remembers the shocking question he asked Mike Dukakis.
Right.
Governor, if Kiki Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer? And, you know, everybody gasps in the room, and Dukakis comes up with that lame answer, no, I don't, Bernard. Mm. And I think you know I've opposed the death penalty. Mm. What shocking question did he ask George Herbert Walker Bush?
I don't remember.
Do you remember?
Who asked him about how much milk cost at the checkout?
It was more shocking.
I don't know.
It's one that they were sort of asking at this last debate. If you were to die before you took office, would you feel comfortable having Dan Quayle as president?
Is that true?
Yes.
Oh, that's a great one.
I know. All right.
By the way, before you go ahead, one of my favorite subscriptions pre-internet, I've said this a million times, there used to be something called the Quayle Quarterly.
Oh, my God.
Which was a newsletter where you got the best quotations from Dan Quayle. And the United Negro College Fund.
How about spelling potato with an E?
The United Negro College Fund is a mind is a terrible thing to waste.
Oh, yeah.
And Dan Quayle at an event said, what a waste it is to lose one's mind or not have a mind at all. How true that is.
Remember correcting the kids, adding the E to potato.
To potato, sure.
Hold on for a second.
What outfit?
Hold on for one second, Emily, real quick. The reason I remember the milk thing, because I don't know the price of milk, and it wasn't, I mean, a lot of people, it doesn't have to do with how much money you have. I mean, I was pretty broke when I was young, and I didn't know the price of milk either, so I thought that was unfair.
That wasn't John Keller by any chance. Was it John Keller that asked? No?
I don't think so.
Okay, go ahead.
Andy Hiller asked the name of the president of Pakistan or something. All right. Do you remember who used to run the presidential debates before the Presidential Debate Commission took over, not until 1992?
I have no idea. Nope. League of Women Voters?
Yes.
Really?
Oh, yes.
There you go.
And they got frustrated and backed out because the candidates were pushing back with all these demands of their own. They said, we just can't do this anymore. All right. Do you remember who was the first woman to solo moderate a presidential debate?
It wasn't Candy Crowley, was it? No?
Close.
Okay. Who?
Barbara Walters.
Oh, and who was it? 84?
And it wasn't until 20 years later that Candy Crowley was the second one. And then later on, it was Judy Woodruff and Gwen
Remember
Eiffel.
When Crowley corrected Mitt Romney and took all that heat for that thing?
Yeah, I can't remember what it was.
Good for her.
We only have a minute.
All right.
Moderated correcting.
Can you remember how many times a woman moderated the first of a series of presidential debates?
So no.
Sometimes a woman has done it, but only one has ever done the very first one.
I don't know.
Barbara Walters.
Oh.
And who has, you remember, who has moderated the most debates ever?
The PBS, Jim Lehrer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and brilliantly, I should say. Really brilliant. That was one of your best ever.
What?
That was terrific.
Well, it wasn't as snarky as you usually are.
Yeah.
But it was great info
like snarky. All right.
For cocktail parties if we ever have them again.
Exactly.
What are you doing tonight?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're looking at what the future of presidential debates and whether it's worth it. You know, the Presidential Debates Commission has lost control, just like the League of Women Voters has. You know, they can't insist on this virtual debate. So whether it's really worth all the time, money, and effort. And then the White House press corps, some of them are now refusing to show up at the White House because of COVID. The BuzzFeed reporter didn't go in.
Uh-huh.
And then we're looking at Mass Live, which actually is a much more successful website. I like it.
I think it's great.
They're terrific. And, you know, they're associated with the Springfield newspaper, The Republican. And they're going to put up a subscription service, and they're hoping, like Boston.com, people will pay for some of their content. So we're
great.
That was really fun. Good to see you.
It was fun.
I
learned a lot, actually. I did. Yeah, that's great. Do you remember the 27-minute gap? How could we have forgotten that?
No. I don't remember what I did, you know,
yesterday,
20 minutes
I know.
ago. Unfortunately.
And
Emily
we know
Rudy
why,
joins us
actually.
Every Friday. You can keep up with her on Friday nights right here on GBH2 at 7 o'clock for Beat the Press. Thanks a lot, Emily Rooney. Up next, Mayor Marty Walsh is here for Ask the Mayor. He'll take our questions and yours. The number is 877-301-8970. The email is bpr@wgbh.org. You can tweet us at Boss Public Radio. Marty Walsh is next. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Boston Mayor Marty Walsh for Ask the Mayor. We'll talk about the city's decision to postpone any additional in-school learning as COVID-19 infection rates rise above the magic 4% level. And we'll open the lines and take your questions for Mayor Walsh.
It's been quite a week. GBH's Callie Crossey will give us an update from the Senate race in South Carolina, a Trump surrogate making racist remarks about Kamala Harris, and food man Corby Kummer on indoor dining. Should you risk it? That and more is ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. GBH. Hello again, Jim.
I think you're about to be the first reporter or radio anchor ever, I'm going to check in a minute, to interview a sitting mayor in an apron. You are really, and I'm serious. I don't know, but I don't think it has ever been done. We'll check. Have the staff check
home.
It out.
I was making some tuna.
And, okay, fine. That's your excuse. Joining us online to take your questions and calls on this month's edition of Ask the Mayor is the mayor, Marty Walsh. You can tweet the mayor at BOS Public Radio. Send them an email at bprwgbh.org. Call him, which is the preferred route, at 877-301-8970. Mr. Mayor, are you offended that Marjorie's wearing an apron, or are you okay with that?
No, I love it, Marjorie. Don't worry about it, Marjorie. And I just want to say one thing before we start the show.
Yeah.
What?
Last month, me and Jim Brody were going back and forth, as we always do, what I think is a joking manner. And people actually thought, like, we were fighting. And I'm like, I wouldn't fight with Jim Brody. I think we had a good back and forth. I don't know what the right, maybe bantering back and forth each other was. But it's never, just so everyone listening, it's never serious. So we razz each other, we go at each other, and there's no, it's nothing ever personal. So anyone who thought that I was fighting with Jim and Jim was fighting with me last month, because I got a lot of calls afterwards, there's no fighting. I respect Jim, and I love Marjorie. I can't say I love Jim, but Marjorie, I love you. I can't say I love the other guy next to you, though.
Thank you,
let
Mr.
me just
Mayor.
Say, if I may, speak for yourself. Now, second, what were we fighting? What were we?
I forget. It was we went back and forth. Maybe it was you asking. I don't know what it was. It was something, and people like, you know, you and Jim Brody went at it. I'm like, no, we didn't. Like, it wasn't. No, we. If anyone listens to the show on a consistent basis, every now and then we'll go back at each other in a jokeful way, but it's never a serious back and forth in a sense of we talk about serious issues all the time, obviously.
All right,
but it's never, you know, I just want to make
okay,
it clear.
Okay, so what you're basically saying
except for,
is
except for right now,
you do I accept
right
your
now.
Apology? I accept your apology if that's what you're saying. So we're set, yeah. Mr. Mayor. Good Jesus, to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
How are you?
Good.
Okay.
Thank you
very much for being here, Mayor Walsh. So let's start. With Boston schools delaying.
An easy topic today?
Yeah, an easy topic. I mean, it's a tough one. You just heard, I don't know if you did hear, but there was a woman with a special need kids who sound like she's kind of in desperate straits. And there are other schools, Catholic schools have opened, charter schools have opened, but there's going to be another delay. So is this what the city should be doing and the school should be doing?
Yeah, we're in a tough place here. I mean, I was on a call yesterday with some charters and some parochial schools and some private schools, and they want most of them are now not the charter schools. A lot of the private schools are all fully in person learning, and they're working through a situation, and they're seeing the numbers like I am, whether it's in a neighborhood or in Boston. We're at a 4.1% rate as of today. Now a new number will come out tonight. So it's a tough situation. You know, everyone has an opinion on this. Everyone's concerned. Parents want their kids back in school. Some parents think it's too dangerous, so they're not sending their kids back to school. When we put our reopening plan together, we took into account different circumstances. Our reopening plan is all opt-in. So parents aren't forced to send their kids to school if they choose not to. We did six phases. We've gone through two of the phases already. One was phase one, which we started all remote. Phase two is the highest need students. Phase three was supposed to start next week on Thursday, unfortunately, on the 15th. But unfortunately, we postponed that now to October 22nd because of the 4% threshold that's in the city of Boston as far as positivity. You know, we set a threshold of 4%. In Boston, generally the focus, the state and the national global health standards have been 5% positivity, but we've been cautious on all of our approaches to this point. So the decision that we made this week when we pushed phase three forward on Wednesday, we made the decision that we were remote on Thursday. Yesterday, we continue to serve our highest need students in our district whose families opted in to begin with. This decision that we made was based on the guidance of our public health experts, working with state officials in public health and education. And it's been consistent with our decision to prioritize our highest need students. And, you know, last week when school opened, I was at three schools. I went to the Ellis, I went to the Carter School in the South End, and I went to Charlestown High School. I saw about a little more than a handful of kids there. And I just saw the joy in their faces, and actually, quite honestly, in the staff and teachers' faces of bringing them back in. And I just felt that when we got to the 4% rate, if there was a way to be able to keep our schools open, I wanted to do that for our families that decided to send their kids to school. Kids with disabilities that are requiring in-person supports, kids who require English language supports, who have limited or interrupt, who have had limited or education, or kids experiencing homelessness or DCF care. So, I mean, these are really the kids that they're all important to get back in school, but if we could keep this open, the numbers were small, roughly about 1,300 we've seen a day come into our schools, which means about an average of 10 per school. And, you know, looking at all the guidance and the health guidance and the precautions, saying that we can have these kids in schools because there's not lots of children and there's not lots of adults in school, and we can keep them safe at this point. Now, that doesn't mean that, and I'll stop talking after this.
That's fine.
That doesn't mean that next week or the week after our rate is at a point and we feel that it's not safe anymore, that we have to shut school down. I'm hoping we go the other way. I'm hoping that we start to see this number come down again. For roughly 16 consecutive weeks, our infection rate was between 1.8% and 28.8%. It's only in the last 3 weeks we saw it from 2.5 weeks, actually, 3.5 to 3.9 to 4.1. So this is kind of I wouldn't call it a surge, but we're in this place that we're watching it very closely.
Now, Mr. Mayor, I actually have a few more school questions. I'm sure they're going to be a lot, but we rarely have 11-year-olds call when you were on, and Alonzo from Boston is on the line, and we don't want to lose him. Oh. So with your permission, we're going to go to the phones right away. Our number is 877-301-8970. Alonzo, you're talking to Mayor Marty Walsh. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi. I'm Alonzo, and I'm calling because some people in my athletic club aren't wearing masks. I'm glad we reopened, but I'm worried because they're not following the mask rules, and I want to do sports, but I'm afraid they'll close because they don't wear masks consistently.
So you want to know what the mayor can do about it, Alonzo?
Wow.
I want to ask what I can say to get them to take the rules and the virus seriously.
Excellent question. Mr. Mayor?
Well, first of all, Alonzo, thank you for calling in. I don't know if you're still on. What's your favorite sport?
Fencing.
Ooh.
Fencing?
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Oh, you're a fancy sportsman. first of all, thank you for calling in. Thank you for taking time. I think that, Alonzo, what I can say to people to make them understand the importance of masks, you said it all. To people listening to this show right now, Alonzo's 11-year-old boy that wants to be able to go back to some semblance of a normal childhood and get back playing sports and in school. And we're asking people, and we've been doing it for the last 7 months, to wear masks, physical social distance, wash your hands. If you don't believe in the virus or you don't think you need to wear a mask, wear it for Alonzo, wear it for the kids, so that we're not shutting everything down. And Alonzo, I'll continue to pass that message along for as long as I have to wear masks and to make sure that people wash their hands and take the precautions. I was just interviewed outside after my flu shot, and I talked about young people. And adults, it's a difficult time for all of us to adapt to the world we're living in today. But think about young people. They were sent home from school in early March. Many of them still have not come back into school. It's now October 9th. Their sports and their life has been completely turned upside down. We're asking them to wear masks and to physical distance. We're asking them not to congregate. Little people, young people like to be able to be with their friends. These are important years for them. We're seeing this coronavirus number move up in the wrong direction. So I'm asking everyone, please, I don't know why I should have to say please, but please, if you're not worried about yourself, then worry about the people around you. If you're not worried about the people around you, worry about our kids.
Alonzo, that was a fabulous question, and you are welcome here any time. So please call us again, and good luck with everything. Mr. Mayor, as I said, I'm sure there are going to be a lot of callers with school questions, so I just have two brief ones. We've read that the teachers union, Boston Teachers Union, is going to go to court to try to get an injunction saying that you had a deal that above a 4% rate, teachers can choose not to go in. Even though I understand your argument as a matter of fairness, these highest need kids are obviously the ones that are most in need of teachers in front of them. On it as a matter of legality, the union is right, aren't they? I mean, this is violative of the agreement, isn't it?
No, not necessarily. I'm a union guy, and let me just read the statement in the MOU. If the citywide COVID rate positivity rate rises above 4% citywide, BPS will transition to fully remote learning for students, and BTU bargaining unit members will have the option to be remote as well. When the Boston Public Health Commission or other city state authorities determines that the school district can reopen, BTU bargaining members will be expected to return to BPS schools. We're looking that phrase right there. We've suspended the other phases, phase 3, 4, and 5. Well, we haven't suspended 4 and 5. They're currently at a date. Hopefully we won't have to postpone them, but we postponed phase 3. And we looked at the numbers of infection rates. We looked at the number of people in the schools. We looked at the status of our schools, all of the precautions we put in place. We're talking about schools that most, and the highest school has 50 students, by the way, mm-hmm. and the average is 10. So we're talking about 10 students in a school that would have hundreds of kids in them that we can protect safely, not only educate and provide the services to our students that need it the most, but we can also make sure that our teachers are safe as well while they're in the buildings. And that's something that, mm-hmm. that we take very seriously. So we take into account, and BPHC and the state and the city and the school department, not the school department, the DESE, I should say, have looking at all these different factors.
One last school thing, and then we'll move on. Our number again is 877-301-8970 if you want to speak directly to Mayor Walsh. Mr. Mayor, early on in the return, we spoke to Brenda Caselius, the superintendent, and we talked about how many kids had yet to even log on. Do you have any idea what the numbers are for those who are not in class, in terms of how many kids there haven't logged on or not, there's no contact with?
I don't have the exact number, but we've been averaging 90% of our students have been logging on. We're higher than what in person was a year ago when we started school. As this conversation continues to go on, I'll try and get the exact Great. Number for the last couple of days for you.
Thanks.
But it's been. I will say this: I've heard a lot of positives from when we started remote learning in early March to May. There was some gains there, and then from the end of school year in June through today, a lot of parents have seen a dramatic difference in the online learning, and that's a testament to the incredible district teachers, principals, and everyone that's done some work over the summer to make sure we have better online learning education going on.
Oh, your mic is
off.
I'm sorry,
Martin, go ahead. We're talking to Mayor Martin Walsh, number 877. 877-301-8970. If you want to call him and talk to him yourself, our email is bpr@wgbh.org. You can tweet us at Boss Public Radio. Mr. Mayor, I know you got an agreement from some of the big landlords in town about evictions. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we have about 25 landlords right now, the biggest landlords that will not, on October 17th when the moratorium ends, will not be evicting, working with their tenants. We're working with tenants as well and landlords to let them know what programs currently exist in the city. So when the moratorium's lifted, we're unsure at this point how many people are actually in the category of being evicted. I'm hearing numbers as high as 40,000 statewide. We're getting calls at our Office of Housing Stability at least four times the rate of this time last year. So eviction certainly. If we have widespread evictions, they're going to create conditions for the virus to spread. So and people are becoming homeless. So we're trying to work as best as we can with landlords, with tenants, with different communities, so that we can keep people in their home. This is a very bad time, obviously, for everyone. We're in a pandemic. Some of the steps that we're taking, also we're helping people access the CDC has a moratorium that will continue to December 31st. City of Boston has a moratorium in place through the end of December as well for public housing. So we're working on that. And on Monday, I filed an ordinance with the council calling for the Office of Housing Stability Notification Act. And what this means is whenever a property owner sends a notice to quit to a tenant, they must accompany that notice with information provided by the city about the rights and resources available for tenants in multiple languages. The city is also going to ask more property owners and managers of low-income apartments to sign a housing stability pledge, which abides by the CDC moratorium on evictions for renters who have lost income due to COVID-19. And now we're seeing the unemployment numbers. I mean, many of our service employees, people working in hospitality, hotels and restaurants, they've lost their work and there's no work there. We also create a renter relief fund in the city, to help people, who are having problems, paying their rent. The fund's distributed more than $3 million in aid. We've covered about 900 households. And I'm working also with the governor and the state on what we can do with this and seeing how we move forward here. So there's a lot going on. I would just ask anyone that's out there listening that's in a situation where you're concerned about the moratorium ending, call the City of Boston's housing, office, 311, so we can give you the proper information that you need.
Just one last thing about this, Mr. Mayor. Obviously, there's a lot of triple-deckers in Boston, a lot of small landlords. They're in a difficult situation, obviously, yeah. If they're a small landlord. What do they do?
We're asking the landlords as well to call us because we have these rental relief funds set up and we have other things. So landlords can call us to assist their tenants as well. So, you know, granted, I know a lot of these programs are set up around tenants, but they also support landlords. And that's one of the concerns that I think we all have. You know, I grew up in Dorchester. I live in Dorchester. I grew up on a street that every house in the street's a three family. You know, my mother still lives in three family. Right. So a lot of people are struggling right now. So the landlords as well. If you own a home, you own a one, two or three family house, you know, contact the City of Boston to see what's out there for your tenants. Because your tenants might not know how to access it, but you can access it through them, for them. And so make sure you take advantage of the programs that we have set up. I think that's really important that we do. Because again, not only am I worried about evictions, I'm worried about foreclosures. And you know, we worked with the banks to create a program earlier in the pandemic to allow people the opportunity to kind of push off their mortgage payments. You should contact your banks as well. And again, the City of Boston is here to help you as well. I mean, we want to help everybody because it's a bad situation all around.
Last couple of quick things, then we promise we'll get to the calls at 877-301-8970. You said you've spoken to the governor. He is disinclined to extend the moratorium past the 17th, which is only, whatever that is, 8 days away. He's talking about other kinds of remedies. Have you urged him to extend the moratorium?
No, we talked about where the moratorium is. I expressed to him some of the concerns that, you know, what we're anticipating here in the city. And I know that our office has been, when I say our office, Housing Department, Sheila Dillon, has been in contact with Mass Housing and other state entities that deal with housing. So I don't have the update on what's been discussed, but we're very close talking to each other about this. You know, Sheila Dillon and our team has some real concerns about what's going to happen, not necessarily on the 18th of October, but what's going to happen on, you know, November 1st, December 1st, and January 1st.
How about, I think it was Lydia Edwards, City Councilor Edwards, who proposed that the Boston Public Health Commission declare a public health emergency because of coronavirus and what the impact would be if people were to be evicted. Are you supportive of that notion?
We're looking into the legality of that. And I'm not sure if we can do that. I think that
if it was legal, would you do it?
If it was legal, we would look at every option, and I probably would put that in place. Because again, my job is to make sure that we protect the tenants and the small and every owner, but a lot of owners here in the City of Boston. We're living in unprecedented times, and you know, there's many homeowners as well that own those homes that Marjorie talked about, even one, two, three families, sure, even six families, that their only income is maybe the rent. They've lost their jobs, and a lot of times these jobs might not come back. I mean, again, you got to remember this: we're doing all of this without any federal assistance. The president has said that he will not do any federal assistance till after the election. That is, I can't believe that even the Republicans in Congress are letting him say that, because this is not a Democrat-Republican pandemic. This is every city across America. And the fact that the federal government and the Senate, Mitch McConnell, will not take this bill up, it's really a tragedy.
Let's go to the calls for Mayor Marty Walsh.
Michaela in Jamaica Plain, you're on with the mayor.
Hi, Michaela.
Hi, my name is Michaela, and I'm a teacher of students with high needs in East Boston, and I'm calling because I really appreciate prioritizing high needs students, but I really feel like we need to put safety first, and we need to be honest with families about the risks and safeguards. And I was hearing you talking about parochial schools, and we don't have the same facilities as those schools have. And I'm frustrated because I feel like there are ways to keep students in person, and I think that includes having more safeguards. So the first question I have is, when is school-by-school's COVID data going to be released so families can have a sense of what's happening in their schools?
What do you mean by COVID, like as far as positives inside
of
school?
Cases.
Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, as of last night, there was no positive cases in any of Boscobel schools. Now, that could change. Obviously, this virus could change very quickly, but there's been no cases that I'm aware of any inside a school. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that families haven't contracted the virus outside of school, but there's no cases that I'm aware of inside Boscobel schools right now, and that includes East Boston.
Okay, and my next question is... that I can just say that I want my high-need students to be in person, but I'm wondering, when is it going to be possible to adapt buildings like the bowling building or city buildings that are currently unused for high-need students, like buildings that are properly ventilated? Because right now, I can tell you in my classroom, I don't feel safe being in there with high-need students because there isn't ventilation and there hasn't been testing done to show what the CO2 levels are when there are people in the building. And I couldn't live with myself if one of my students or their families got sick after being in person with me. And their education is so important to me. I say that with all my heart, but I had a lot of students who were sick last year, and I wouldn't be able to live with myself if one of them or their family got sick. So.
Yes, Mr. Mayor.
Let me just, before I answer that question, let me just first of all thank you, Michaela. I should have thanked you when you first called in, when I first heard you as a teacher. Our teachers in Boston have been putting up with a lot of stress since March of last year. And just real quickly, I mean, I've talked to enough teachers that they love their students, they love their kids. In March 17th, we had to send everyone home. The teachers had to transition to online learning and teaching online, which probably never thought you'd have to do in grammar schools in Boston or any place. So thank you for that, and thank you for what you do. And East Boston has some amazing schools. You don't have to tell me the school you're in, but they're all amazing schools, amazing school leaders. And in the beginning of talking about reopening, East Boston was in a different position because the positivity rate at one point in East Boston was 11.4%. So that was another burden on people. As far as the schools goes and being safe, the Bowling Building probably has good ventilation. I don't know if I'd recommend, I'd say that City Hall is good ventilation here because I don't know if you've ever been in here. It's a big concrete block that was built in 1968, and I'm not sure how good the ventilation is. But two things. One is the protection in the schools right now. Some of the things, wearing masks and having airflow going through the building is something that is a priority for the district. The second thing is we have done some air testing in all our schools. The issue, as Michaela pointed out, that we can't really get an accurate count of air quality because we don't have many people in the schools. So we are working on that as we speak. We're also working on bringing in some other air quality purifiers and things like that to go into our schools. The last thing you talked about was using a building like the Bowling Building or even some of our newer schools as places where we could kind of maybe have teaching. If we stay in the situation we're in today and we want to bring in the special ed kids, if you will, one of the things that the district has pointed out that it's about an equity issue as well, and I think that we have to, as we move forward in this world of COVID that we're in today, we are going to look at are we better serving our kids if they're coming into school in different buildings where we can add additional protection. So I appreciate all your concerns, Michaela. I thank you for the call, and we'll continue to work on it. And I would suggest to you, if you can call me directly anytime if you'd like as well. I'd love to hear from you.
Michaela, thank you very much for your thoughtful call. We appreciate it.
Mr. Mayor, this is a statewide thing, not just a Boston thing, but we had Governor Gina Raimondo on a couple of weeks ago talking about schools in Rhode Island, and she brought on the National Guard to do things like stick fans in the windows and had a kind of a nonstop, seemingly a more aggressive approach to we're going to get the kids back in school in person, and a lot of them are back in person. Sometimes it seems to me that we've been a little less urgent about this state, not just in Boston, but statewide, with people not really knowing what they're doing until September, and not really an effort to, you know, a lot of kids are going to school outside. You know, there's, I'm two blocks from a school in Brookline. Obviously, Brookline is a more affluent town than Boston, at least big sections of Boston. But they've got tents outside. The kids are outside. Sometimes it seems like we just are not that innovative and creative.
Let me just, you know, Michaela brought up a point about the Catholic schools being better prepared, the buildings. And
not
some,
all of
some
them.
Some are and some aren't.
Yeah, exactly.
The tricky thing here in Boston, I think, is that we have 125 different schools and buildings. And we have 54,000 kids that are in our district. And they're not really neighborhood schools. So we're talking about a one-off school like a Catholic school or a private school that only has to focus on that one school, where we're focusing on 125 schools. And you know, there are kids that wake up in the morning in Dorchester and they get bused across the city to Brighton.
Yep.
There are kids that go that live in Mattapan and they're bused across in different places. So that's what makes it more challenging here, because we're a district and we're not one-off schools. And to control that is difficult, because we're transporting kids all across the city, or they're taking public transportation when we're back in school. We have done all of the things of buying fans, 5,000 fans. We've done assessments of windows. We have an operable window in every classroom, and we have fans in them. We're actually renovating more windows. We found 7,000 deficient windows in the district, so we're in the process of fixing those. We had to create nurse's office. We had to create an isolation space, and many of our nurses' offices, they were room. And we had to create a separate space for isolation in the event we have some child that comes down with symptoms of what coronavirus could be. And so I think that, you know, I would say that the approach that we've taken here in Boston and Massachusetts, not just on schools but everything, being cautious is really the smart thing to do, because we've seen in other states of these states that kind of shut down and then they reopened and then they had to shut down again, like Florida. Florida kind of shut down, then they reopened fully, and then they had to shut down again, and then they reopened fully again. And you know, I think that we want to try and prevent having these, you know, having to continue to open and close. When we came up with the school plan, the way we came up with it, with the phase-in approach, you know, it was thought through, because we knew that at any given point, if we had to shut school down, we didn't have to shut it down across the board unless we were open across the board. So the way it worked out for us right now is that phase three is supposed to open next Thursday, but we were able to delay it a week, and we put 2 weeks between every category so that we could monitor this information. As I said in the very beginning, from the end of June and through pretty much the end of August, our infection rate was 1.8 to 2.8%. And in the last 2 weeks, we've seen it go from 2.8 to 3.5 to 3.9. So we're seeing, again, it's not a spike, but we're seeing an increase. And that's what, this virus is so unpredictable. And that's what, for me, it's frustrating for a lot of people. And a lot of people, I think, I mean, we forget, but subconsciously we think like, okay, we'll be on the toughest days of the virus. I hope we are, but I can't honestly say on the radio today that we are, because we're seeing the numbers go in the wrong direction.
Mr. Mayor, we got to take a break in a minute, but before we do, speaking of kids, we've talked on the air about what happens with Halloween, which is actually a pretty serious topic, despite, in addition to
very
the fact
serious.
That it's a fun time. The governor said he didn't want to shut things down statewide because his fear is everybody move inside, which is a problem. He said he's leaving it up to cities and towns. What's Boston going to do, or what are you recommending?
It's funny. I should have an answer right now for you, because I've been asked three times on this. This is my third time, and I don't have my public health folks telling what to do. But what I said yesterday and today and Wednesday right now, I would like to have Halloween. I agree with the governor. I think that having indoor parties cannot happen because they potentially become spreading events, super spreaders, and we don't want that to happen. And my public health department is working now to see how, you know, 2 months ago they were like, no Halloween, you can't do it. But I think that if there's a way for us to do it, it's outside. people can distance, but I think that there'd have to be some precautions put in place that people giving candy out would have to probably wear gloves and wear masks, because again, not to spread the virus, but we're not there yet. I will have an announcement on that at some point, but you know, our kids have been hit the hardest of, and in a lot of ways, everyone's been hit hard in the virus, but for the little ones, you know, Alonzo called in the first call to call in. I mean, they lost school, they're losing sports, they're losing everything, and they're trying to figure out what's going on here.
We're going to take a break.
Yes, we are. We're talking to Mayor Marty Walsh. He's going to be with us till the top of the hour. He's taking our questions and your calls. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marguerite. And Mayor Marty Walsh is joining us, as he does every month, for Ask the Mayor. He's with us till the top of the hour. Call him at 8. Lines are full, but when they're not, 877-301-8970. Let's go to Katie in Boston. Welcome, Katie.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
So I am also a teacher in BPS, which has been my dream from when I started studying education. And I'm so grateful every day that I get to work with my students and their families. And I want to say that my explanation that I've been giving is that the left hand doesn't know what the right is doing right now. Teachers are hearing that there are absolutely positive cases in schools. The superintendent, I believe, said last night that there were 4 cases. So I'm concerned that the mayor hasn't heard that. Teachers were supposed to be given an option to work remotely. The principals are being directed to threaten people who choose that option with insubordination. Accommodations are barely being offered for staff, and educators are being forced into leave. And it makes me worried that we have classes that don't have a teacher of record. The MOA, in my opinion, said that a 4% would trigger all remote, which I don't really understand why we're using a rate based on the city at whole instead of a weighted rate based on students. Neighborhoods where they live. I teach in Hyde Park where the rate is 8%. Fans don't fit. Windows are like, it's going to get cold really, really soon. What if pipes first? Some of our nurses.
Katie, can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Masks.
Katie, if I can, your connection is bad and I'm worried before you get to your question, we're going to lose you. So can you ask your question so we don't lose you?
Yeah. My question is, like, I would really like hard and fast facts, like what triggers closure? What is the percent? What is the number of cases in a particular school? Equality is giving everyone the same thing. Equity is giving people what they need. So where are these, like, hard and fast facts that my family can plan on?
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, Katie. First of all, Katie, thank you for your work. Thank you for what you do. The rate of closure is above 4%. We're at 4.1%. And we closed, for all intents and purposes, with the exception of the highest need school students, and we closed schools down when the Boston Public Health Commission or the city or state authorities deemed the schools districts can reopen. Then we could reopen for a small, we reopened for a small portion of our kids. I heard from parents, too many parents, and teachers and children who have told me how vital it is for a high need student's well-being to be in the classroom. I've seen it with my own eyes. I want to be just as clear as I can be. We will continue to ensure the schools are prepared to protect the health and safety of our students, our teachers, and all the people, any of the people who are in them. We're going to continue to monitor the data. We're going to continue to ensure that safety for every individual enters the building is safe. We put in the precautions in place. And all of that. I mean, we have buildings that are old. We're not the only district in the country that has that. But when I was at the Carter School the other day and I saw, some of the highest need students, you know, just, you know, in 2 days being back, thriving and being happy for opt-in for parents, I felt really good about it. And I think that, It's incumbent upon all of us. If we can make this work, we make this work. If I'm not talking about having hundreds of students in a building, you know, most schools have an average of 8 to 10 students in the building. You know, it's safe. And it's safer than a restaurant. People go into restaurants where there's, you know, 50% capacity or what have you. It's safer than being in a supermarket. It's safer than being, you know, whatever people do on the outside. And that's what, you know, listen, the last thing that I want to do here is get into a conversation or a battle, with the teachers union. And, you know, the other day I did have a conversation with the teachers union to see how we could do this. And, you know, and we're talking right now, maybe not this moment, but we talked yesterday, and I'm trying to get to an understanding. There's many people, including teachers, that also think that if we can do it safely, we should be educating and helping our highest need students. This is about the highest need students. And this is maybe not a popular decision, and there's people that aren't happy with me about it in the teachers union, and I appreciate and I understand people's concerns, but also throughout this pandemic, we have to be creative in how we can do things. These kids have not had services for 7 months. You know, some of the families have the ability to be able to get service for their children. Many of the districts that we have are poor. You know, 87% of our district are poor kids. They're on free and reduced lunch. We serve 2 million meals over the summer to them because they're broke and they're poor. They don't have the ability to send the kid to private school. They don't have the ability to get counselors inside. They don't have the ability to get tutors inside. I know everyone knows this. So I'm asking again that we're talking about our highest need students. I'm not doing this because it's making me popular, and I'm not doing this because it's making me unpopular. I'm doing this because I know we all care about these kids, and that's why. And if we feel that it's not safe to be in a building, we will not open the building. I've been probably the most conservative mayor in the beginning, shutting things down, meaning things going down so fast, including construction. And everyone got mad at me for closing construction, and the state didn't agree with me. But we shut it down. And then opening things up, we're taking it very slow. We have not moved into phase three, step two at the state level. We have not increased the restaurant seating from 6 to 10. Restaurants are mad at me. I mean, when I say mad, they're upset. I appreciate it. I understand that. But I also think in this particular case, when it comes to kids and the students that I saw, that it's the right place to be. As soon as we feel, and the public health experts who have guided us all along this way and who I think have done a very good job say to me, we can't be in school anymore, it all gets shut down. If we feel that we can open school, we open it. People even resisted the fact that we should even have to do the hybrid model and opt-in for parents. This is all opt-in for parents. So, and I appreciate Katie, you know, Katie shared a lot of facts there and information there. And, you know, some of that's talking points, and we're going to hear probably from 4 other callers the same talking points. And I appreciate that. But we're trying to get to a point where we can all understand. And I think everyone understands. Jessica Tang said this yesterday and the day before, that she understands also the importance of having these young people in classrooms, particularly the highest needs. There's no doubt we all agree on that. But again, you know, I want to, if we can, we should be able to make this work.
Katie, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. We're talking to Mayor Marty Walsh, 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Laura in Smithfield, Rhode Island. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Laura. We'll get to Laura in a second.
Person?
Laura,
I'm
sit tight for 1 second. We'll get there in a minute. Anne,
yeah,
you're in Mission Hill.
Mission Hill.
Our apologies. We made a mistake. Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, and thank you for taking the time to chat with me this morning. Being that Massachusetts is a right-to-shelter state and there are a significant number of people still unhoused in the city of Boston, what is your plan with the upcoming winter to find unhoused residents permanent housing solutions? And in addition to that, how are you going to handle the surge in homelessness that's going to occur when the evictions moratorium comes down in a week?
Thank you very much. Let me start with that. I'm hoping that we won't see a surge in homelessness, obviously. And a lot of those homelessness that we're talking, potential homeless we're talking about are families. And I don't think we'll see it. Like I said earlier on the show, I don't know if you were on the radio, we won't see it the next day, but certainly it's a concern of all of mine. And over the last 7 years since I've been mayor, we've been building housing. We've been building more housing in the last 7 years than almost any other period in the history of the city, maybe since the beginning. On our homeless population, from the very beginning of the pandemic, we were able to create five or six different locations around the city. We were able to take our homeless population from concentrated shelters and be able to put them in different areas, whether it was for quarantine or for safe spaces for people to live. We're working right now on creating a plan for the winter time that we won't have our, we can't overcrowd our shelters because COVID's still going to be here, and we're looking at different sites in the city to be have them as temporary shelters. During the pandemic, we've housed 250 chronically homeless people in housing. Just so people understand, when you think talk about the house, the homeless situation or the homeless structure, the state is responsible for family homelessness, and they work on programming on family homelessness with some of our assistants, and individual cities and towns are responsible for the homeless individuals. So since 2015 to right now in Boston, we've housed 2,250 homeless individuals into permanent housing with wraparound supports. We have about 440 units of housing under construction right now in partnership with a whole bunch of organizations, and we're also working with our shelter system to expand that. We've also, during the pandemic, we were able to get 1,000 housing vouchers and prioritize our homeless families, and we've been able to, I believe, 800 plus homeless families have housing in the city of Boston at the beginning of the pandemic didn't. So it's a top priority of mine. It's something that we focus on, very, very, very much focused on, every day here in the city. So thank you for the call.
And thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Mr. Mayor, you commented on this at a press conference on Wednesday, but just to ask for the update, I mean, really, kind of a scary situation. Roslindale man, Benna Arpriella, I believe I'm pronouncing it correctly, black guy, was jogging VFW in West Roxbury. West Roxbury's a pretty white neighborhood. When these two SUVs with tinted windows approached, and as it's been reported, one blocked the sidewalk in front of him, the other pulled up next to him. Three guys got out, didn't identify themselves. They were all white, and began asking him questions about his identity. And all I could think of was this poor guy was probably in total fear for his life after what, you know, has gone down in this country over recent months. And at least initially, ICE would refuse to confirm or deny that these were ICE agents. I mean, this is Boston. You just don't expect this kind of thing here, I guess.
No, I talked to Bina. His name is Bina. I talked to Bina on the next day. I got a phone call from a family member of his that I know very well, and I spoke to him, and you know, he was definitely concerned. It wasn't a West Roxbury issue. He was jogging on the West Roxbury Parkway. According to ICE, I think I've seen reports since then that they were looking for somebody in the area they were looking for, but I did have a conversation with him, and we talked it through a little bit. I'll leave the conversation as a private conversation. I don't want to say anything that he wouldn't want me to say, but certainly I had concerns for him, and you know, really nice person. We had about a 10-minute conversation. I have to follow up with him, but you know, this, you know, at this point in time, you know, he was jogging, you know, not causing problems. He did get kind of rolled up on. People jumped out of the car. I think that the way that it was done, I understand if you're looking for somebody, that's one thing, but I don't necessarily think that that's the approach you have to take. But again, I don't have all the particulars why they would do it. I have talked to some folks at ICE just to talk about the situation and the way it looks. It doesn't look good. And certainly the response that they did put out information they're looking for somebody else. But again, I think that Bina deserves an apology.
What did the people at ICE tell you?
They were just saying that it was after the fact that they put a statement out, just that they were looking for somebody, you know, in that area that they were trying to apprehend. That was, you know, I think it was, I don't know what to tell publicly, but you know, had done some bad things. And I just, you know, again, when I talked to Bina, we had a really great conversation. I passed along, you know, I said to him, sorry, even though it had nothing to do with Boston and or the city or even our law enforcement here in Boston, the police department, you know, it's scary. I mean, we've heard stories for the last 5 years, 4 years by this administration in Washington that ICE is coming, ICE is coming, ICE is coming. And the first thing I thought of, if ICE is starting to come in and just randomly pull people over, it wasn't the case per se, but randomly pull people over and ask their immigration status, that's concerning. Bina did say to them that, you know, he's not an immigrant, and their response was, well, we don't just deal with immigrant issues. So there was a whole other piece of this.
But I guess
it was scary.
I guess the thing that's scary is, to me, is that they are randomly stopping people. I mean, okay, they say they're looking for a Haitian who's black. This guy's black. So a guy's jogging, I mean, when you see the video, if I were this guy, I would have been petrified. It's very aggressive. I mean, they're asking him, he's got tattoos on his arms and stuff like that. It was a very scary situation. Is ICE entitled to say, okay, well, we had a suspect, so we're going to stop a black jogger? You know what I mean? It does seem
the rules and regulations have to be consistent. As we're looking here in Boston at, you know, we're looking at use of force policy and all of that stuff. We're doing that here in the city. I mean, obviously, right now in the federal government, I don't think there's any point of trying to have conversations around what their use of force policies. I don't think we have an ear that's sympathetic to anything that the rest of us are working through as cities across America. In the issues here in Boston, when we talk about policing and reform and things like that, I mean, every city in town is grappling with, most cities and towns in America are grappling with this issue and working on this issue. And we have a federal government that just, I mean, we pick up the paper every day. We see, you know, Trump was sending troops into different cities around America, just randomly sending troops in different authorities. It's sending very, very mixed messages to all different communities across our country.
Alice from Boston, you're on with the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Mayor. I'm Alice. I live in Chestnut Hills. It's a tiny little section of Chestnut Hills. That's Boston. And I've been unable to figure out where I can deposit my ballot.
Oh, I'm so glad you called.
If I don't want to put it in the mail.
Oh, great.
I really don't want to come into City Hall. As I said, I'm a senior. I have health issues. I very rarely leave my condo. So where can I drop my ballot off?
I'm talking to Audrey sitting next to me. So ballot box drop-offs start, I believe, in a week from now. We're going to have 17 drop box locations around the city of Boston. We'll have one in your area. If you go to the, I don't know if you use a computer. If you go to the computer.
I do. All the time.
Go to the city of Boston website and go to the election department. We'll have a list of the 17 locations. We're also going to have 27 early vote locations around the city, so you can either drop it off at a ballot box, which is going to be 24 hours a day, or if you want to go to an early vote location in your area, you can drop it off there, starting, I believe, in a week. But before I end the show, I will have the times. Actually, give me 20 seconds here.
Give you 20 seconds, Mr. Mayor.
Here we go. Just information for elections, and I'll get to your point in a second. August 22nd, no, that's the wrong date. No, we'll be on
right.
August 22nd.
That was what I was finding, August.
He's finding it, Alice. Be patient.
October 24th, Saturday, October 24th, 8 p.m. is the voter registration deadline. October 24th, 8 p.m. October 17th through October 30th will be early vote period in the city of Boston. You can go online to find the early vote locations in your area. On October 28th, the deadline for requesting a vote by mail ballot. So I would suggest you do it long before the 28th to ask for a vote by mail ballot, which means you'll put the application in to the city and then we'll mail it back to you.
And when did you say when did you say the 17 Dropbox facilities will be open?
I still have to get that for you. Give me a minute. I'm looking on the... November 2nd is the deadline for in-person absentee voting. That will be here at City Hall. And then November 3rd is the election. Let me get the drop box. Give me 1 second here.
Alice, why don't you just keep... keep listening. Don't go away. In the next 5 minutes, the mayor will say on the air what the drop box dates are. Thank you very much for raising that
and
question.
All election information, if you're on computers, all election information, you go to election@boston.gov. If you want to call the election department directly, you can either call 311 or you can call 617-635-8683.
Thanks.
You know, Mr. Mayor, one thing about this mail-in ballot and all this, every day there's another story, not about the fraud that the president keeps talking about, but just kind of, I don't even want to say ineptitude, because these poor town clerks are overwhelmed. They have all these people applying for absentee ballots or mail-in ballots that they've never had before. There was a story in the Globe today about how Secretary of State Galvin's website, his mobile website, was saying you had to have your election ballot in by September 1st. Obviously, that's not right. They duplicated the November thing by mistake, and I guess they had it right in the desktop version. They had towns in Falmouth, Bedford, Dennis, Haverhill, Hopkinton, Waltham, were the same thing. They got these ballots that said you had to have your November 3rd vote in by September 1st. How worried are you? I mean, Massachusetts is a pretty is probably not going to support President Trump. I think that's a fair thing to say. But this is just because the clerks are overwhelmed and so many places haven't done this before, I think this could be a recipe for disaster if people use mail-in votes in great numbers around the country.
Yeah, let me just, Massachusetts, the Secretary of State has done a very good job in his office of making sure that we have the rules and regulations for voting, and they monitor every city and town clerks very closely to make sure that all the policies are in place. So as far as voting in Massachusetts, I'm in Boston, I'm not expecting any voter intimidation. We're not going to tolerate it. We're going to have, I think we already have requested, I think there's 150,000 mail-in ballots already requested here in Boston, then there'll be more coming in. We've already sent out, we've sent out 27,000 ballots to people. The number's probably higher now. We've already received back over 1,000. So I think that my suggestion to people is there should be plenty of access to voting here in the city. I think when it comes to what the president has been kind of subtly putting out there is that mail-in ballots don't allow people they don't have to go vote in person, which cuts down on the intimidation stuff. And I think that's a horrible message to be sent by the president of the United States of America. We saw in Boston the mail-in system work. In Boston, just so everyone knows, there was ballots in Boston that were not counted, but they had to be received by election night. For the final, for the general election, we have to, every ballot that we receive, I believe we count up till the 6th of November. The election's the 3rd, we count every ballot up to the 6th. So, but I would tell people, like Alice did, get your ballot in early, vote early, get it in, so that we're not worried about you not making last minute arrangements.
We only have a minute left, but I really want to get Kelsey from Boston. And Kelsey, unfortunately, we're short on time, but I think you have an important message, so... welcome. Hi.
Hi, Mr. Mayor. How are you? I just wanted to call. Hi there. I just wanted to call quickly because my son, who is 7 years old, is one of the lucky students who has been welcomed back this past week as a high needs student at Boston Public Schools, to be back at the only place that has and can meet his needs medically, educationally, otherwise. And I am so, so pleased that the city, the superintendent, you, Mayor, have listened and made a true point of prioritizing these students and their needs. And I've been saying for a bit, I think people sometimes don't understand that, we call them students with high needs for a reason. This isn't something they want or wish for. It doesn't make the decision to send them back any easier. But we have no other choice. It's not a matter of convenience, but such necessity. And our city is coming to our aid in that way. And I'm proud of those teachers, truly, for doing the work that we at home cannot do for these kind of kids. They are the most vulnerable among us. And so I just wanted to say I'm proud of our city for taking a stand in support of those kids. We need so much help. And you'd said a while ago that, we were relying on you as our city. Our city is our choice, and we need you badly. So I wanted to say that and then ask you, what can we from, the community of families with these high-need students expect in terms of seeing that they'll be continued to be made a priority when it most matters? I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelsey.
Thank you, Kelsey. Kelsey said it all there. I left my house the other day on Tuesday, and we knew that I had a feeling that the numbers were going to be 4.1%, and to be quite honest with you, and this isn't meant to rile people up, but when I left the house, Laurie asked me about what was going to happen today, and I said, you know, some people are going to be upset with me with the decision that we're potentially going to make here by keeping schools open for the highest need students. This is not a political decision. This decision that we're making here is based off of Kelsey's child and the kids and the people that I saw in school the other day that, you know, a little boy that was a young man that was communicating by smile and another young man that was communicating by eyes, nonverbal. Those students need to be in school. If we can create a safe environment for those students to be in school, then I'm not worried about the political fallback on me personally, quite honestly. I'm worried about, I didn't get elected to be mayor of Boston to make easy decisions. I ran for mayor, and I'm the mayor to make, unfortunately, sometimes very difficult decisions. And this is a difficult decision. There's a lot of emotion on both sides. I love and respect the teachers that are upset with me right now because they do amazing work. And I also love and respect the young people in our district that need the help to get the best help in education and physical therapy they need. And that's what right now we're working towards. And I appreciate the call, Kelsey. I appreciate also Katie's call. I appreciate Michaela's call. I appreciate all the teachers that are on hold right now that wanted to, you know, just let me know how they feel. I appreciate all the work you do. And we're in very extraordinary circumstances in life right now. And I just, the last thing I want to say on this call today is that there is a lot of stress in a lot of people's lives. And we are all on edge to some degree. There's unrest politically, there's unrest racially, there's unrest financially, there's unrest all over the place. And I'm just asking us all, we're in this together. We're in this together. And that's what makes us all Boston strong. So I just want to thank everyone for your opinions and your feelings and your emotion, your passion. That's who we are as a city, and we will all get through this.
Mr. Mayor, thanks so much for the extra time. We really appreciate you coming on today. Thanks.
Thanks for having me. Maj, you look great today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. Great to talk to you as always. We appreciate your time. Several emailers alerted me. I apparently had the day off when you and the mayor were going back and forth.
What was it about?
It was about his reelection, whether he's going to run for reelection. That apparently was that about you. Do you remember that, Jim?
No.
Okay. Well, some of our studio emailers apparently do remember it, so thank you for that.
Yeah, Marjorie was referencing the opening comments the mayor said today, but you can listen when it's on gbhnews.com or .org, not right now. Go ahead, because we're a little behind.
Okay, coming up, how President Trump extended his virus touch to restaurant staffers in a Minneapolis steakhouse. Food writer Corby Cummer joins us for that and more. He's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. The pandemic is giving new meaning to eating out, as in eating outdoors. As the days get shorter and colder, dining al fresco will soon mean dining al freezing, and restaurants are wrestling with how to manage the call of the great indoors. Joining us to talk about how the restaurant industry is adapting to indoor dining and how customers are as well is Corby Cummer. Corby's the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello, Corby Cummer.
Good afternoon.
And to you.
Hey, Corby Cummer, great to talk to you. So, we, a lot of us, because it is getting colder, and not everybody's been able to get these heat lamps, I guess. So if you're going to go eat outside coming up, you're going to have to wear your ski parka and your ski hat. How nervous should we be about going inside?
Moderately nervous. You should be paying a lot of attention to what the restaurants are doing. So ventilation is a really big deal, and asking the restaurant how it can get fresh air in and increase the circulation of fresh air. If you see open windows, you decide you're going to wear your parka indoors as well, because fresh air is the key. There's been very little documented transmission of people outdoors. It's relatively quite safe. If you are not shouting, the noise level is low. You take the precautions of always wearing your mask when you are at the table, not when you're enjoying your meal, but the minute the server comes to the table, you wear your mask. I would say if the restaurant is saying right in its window, and if you call them, if you write them, if they put on their website exactly what they've done to increase fresh air ventilation, so they're very specific about what they're doing, if they are specific in their requests asking you to wear a mask when you are talking to anyone, when you are waiting for your table, when you're waiting for the bathroom, these are all things in a diner code of conduct that I'll certainly be releasing with a huge flourish, I hope, including on this show.
Good. Oh, good.
And if the restaurants and if the cities are taking the care that Los Angeles and Philadelphia are taking the lead in, which is giving restaurants online training for COVID preparedness, and after they complete that online training, letting them print out a form that says, we are COVID ready, we have done this, and if you see any violations of these rules, call this number. Those are things that can help ensure security. But I think what we're seeing in Boston is a number of restaurants are saying 25% never going to work economically. I'm not going to open under those circumstances. And others like Vivi and Jamaica Plain are saying, we're in an old building. We looked into it. We can't increase our ventilation. We're not opening.
Well, also, a lot of our favorite restaurants, I know from what we talked about, have small insides, so it's almost impossible unless they want to endanger people. You know, I hope I get this right, and one of you will probably know if I'm wrong. I think the rules for indoor dining in this state is that if you have to wear a mask into the restaurant.
Right.
You have to wear a mask if you get up from the table and walk around either to whatever, so they go to the men's or women's room or something, but you do not need to wear it at the table when you're not eating or drinking. I know that some states do require you to have it on at all times, even at the table, unless you're eating or drinking. I know that's inconvenient, and I know people don't want to do it, but isn't that a much safer way to proceed, both for you and for the server, Corby?
The most that I've seen states require is that you wear a mask when you're interacting with servers, which is where I think it's really important. Yes, ideally you would wear your mask whenever you're not eating. Why would that be? Because you could be yelling. You could be singing. There's this risk of possible transmission and waving around. The more you have your mask off, the longer you're there, the higher the risk. There's just no way around it. And so saying wear your mask at all times when you're not actually putting something in your mouth is probably a good idea. And if it seems really outlandish, we're used by now to having conversations while wearing a mask. It's not our ideal. It's requiring a lot better enunciation. But it's something that people do. If they are meeting in their backyards with somebody they haven't seen in a long time, so they haven't quarantined, they'll wear their mask. If they're taking a walk together around Jamaica Pond or the Common, they'll wear their masks. So I think that it's not so outlandish a request, but states and cities are being very shy and very hesitant about it. New York State said, we want you wearing a mask when you're interacting with your server. New York City had not said that yet, so they're changing to the state. All these states and cities are kind of having little skirmishes.
You know, speaking of the greater Boston, I assume the only information you have is anecdotal from what you've read, heard, spoken to restaurateurs. Do you have any back-of-the-envelope kind of sense of how many places are actually doing indoor dining, meaning at least have some alternative for survival come the time that even if they have a heater, it's too cold for people to be outside?
My sense is that it depends on how big the space is. And so if they feel that there's any kind of path to even breaking even by having reduced seating in a large space, they're able to space their tables. That gives them a level of security that they can make to their servers and staff. Then they're thinking hard of reopening. But, you know, there's a very eloquent piece in the Boston Globe about local restaurateurs and what they're thinking. And it, a lot of it took off from one of the owners of Mamala's and State Line, or is it State Farm?
State Park.
State Park, thank you. These restaurants in which she was saying, we've been able to use parking lots, use outdoor seating, and a lot of takeout and delivery as economically viable alternatives just to stay alive and not have to close permanently. We were able to start making those pivots. Or I'm very interested in what the restaurants in Central Square that all banded together to use that great parking lot behind, right behind Central Square.
Fabulous.
Where the H Market is, the old Bread and Circus and Whole Foods. But that's transformed into outdoor dining. So a number of restaurants, Branch Line in Watertown, which had a big parking lot, if they found these alternatives, they've seen ways of getting around having to have dense indoor dining. But I think only the places that feel confident that they can up their filters to MERV 13, they can increase the fresh air coming into their restaurants, they can make the numbers work for the size of their dining room and spacing, are feeling confident that they can even try doing it. And the Globe piece had some detail from local restaurant owners, but mostly it's a question of space and ventilation.
You know, I don't know if you are familiar with what the state of the legislation that's pending on Beacon Hill, that Mass Restaurants United, mostly small independent restaurants, have been pushing. Tony Maws, Jody Adams, mm-hmm. Bessie King, a whole bunch of people, and legislation pending in Washington. And I don't think anything has passed other than individual things. For example, the governor released a little bit more money for people to buy heaters and that sort of thing. I don't understand why, for example, oh, by the way, I didn't even tell you this, Marjorie. In the last few minutes during the break, we learned that the president, who wasn't going to negotiate anymore about a comprehensive coronavirus relief package, is now supporting a $1.8 trillion package and is tweeting, go big. So obviously the steroids are either wearing off or having a different effect.
Let's hope he pushes it quickly.
But you know, even after he tweeted no more negotiations, whatever it was, yesterday morning or whatever it was, he was willing to do a bailout for the auto industry. Why is the restaurant industry so much lower on the priority scale? I'm guessing there are far more workers in the restaurant industry than there are in the airline industry. And I assume they have a lot of power. Why
it's
are
because
they not
they
getting
they don't
anywhere?
Have the collective corporate power that the airlines do. They don't have a line in to the Republican White House and big lobbyist power that other industries that are greatly affected, hotel industry, but certainly the airline industry. You saw Trump trying to negotiate a separate deal with Pelosi, right, who said no separate, no side deals.
Is that because they're so concentrated, meaning it's three or four big boys who run the whole deal as opposed to the more spread out in the restaurant world? Is that what you're saying?
I think it's because the National Restaurant Association, which is a great group that's composed of all the 50 state restaurant mm-hmm. organizations, collectively, in theory, they would have a lot of power, but because it's so dispersed, it's so regionalized, it's so local, even the large chains, it's only the largest chains that are fast food that have any kind of real influence in the White House, that there isn't this kind of bargaining power. But when you're talking about the great restaurants bill that Jody Adams and Tony Maws and Ken Oringer and others are fighting for in the state legislature, I've been celebrating the passage by the House of the Restaurants Act, which is a bailout. It does offer rent relief. It does offer employee relief. It managed – it was such a long shot in the House of Representatives, but the beginning of last week, it passed the House. So it will, in theory, if House and Senate and White House can think of the next or negotiate for the next relief bill, the Restaurants Act could be part of it. It got so much farther than anyone nationally expected it to.
So one of the other changes that is, I guess, has been around here and there, but all of a sudden picking up speed big time because of COVID protocols, is the digital menu. And then when people finally figure out how to use a QR code, it seems to me, once we get used to that, this is brilliant environmentally and in terms of cost for the people who own the restaurants. This is the future, not just the present with the pandemic. Is that true?
I would completely agree. And I would say, you know, sorry, White House, but China is so far ahead of us in the QR code and ordering. But let's have a word for Boston and Roger Berkowitz at Legal Seafoods, which did Legal Test Kitchen. Do you remember when they gave people iPads when they came in, and you would order everything on a device, which, you know, frankly, airline, all of the airport restaurants at LaGuardia and some of them at Logan had this method in place for a long time. Now there's no touch involved. The great criticism was, hey, I want to interact with my server, mask on or off. Just kidding about the mask. It was all machine. It was depersonalizing. It was taking away tips. But now you get from a paper menu, which is most restaurants' fallback, so it's disposable. You don't have to worry about cleaning it between diners, to actual touchless menus. So it's right there. You scan it. You put in your order online. The restaurant gets it. My longtime dream is being achieved even in local restaurants, which say, hey, order a drink in your first course before you even come in the door while you're waiting for the table. Yeah. My years of being a restaurant critic, while I was made to wait forever for tables, I would say, hey, could we at least order the food? And they would say, no. You know, we'd look at the menu and we knew. But, Jim, when you say QR codes are the wave of the future, how comfortable are you scanning a QR code? How many times have you gone into a supermarket and said, I don't care about GMO-free labeling because I know that it's on the QR code, that there are all kinds of facts about exactly what goes into this food stuff that are on the QR code, and I'm going to whip out my phone and go onto the QR code. I'm setting you up, but I'm also asking you.
Well, unfortunately, I can't answer the question because I'm so focused on you calling Roger Berkowitz a revolutionary that I just I just
– visionary.
A visionary, which he is, by the way. We love Roger, I should say. I mean, where are you going with this? Do I love the QR? I love everything about it. I love every – and by the way, I was a resister. I should be honest. I'm only there because I had to be there because I like eating outside during a pandemic so you can at least get out of the house here and there. But I was a resistor, and it's fabulous. And so your point is that the QR code not only serves the functional purpose in the time of the pandemic with a menu, but also allows you access to lots of other wildly important and useful information. Is that what you're saying?
There's all sorts of great things that QR codes can enable, but my real point is most people are resistors. Naomi Starkman, who started Civil Eats, a great website, was personally doing research for a project for a PhD she was taking. She's wildly accomplished. But it was exactly how often consumers do use QR codes at supermarkets. And the answer was even in the Bay Area, very ultra-sophisticated technologically, almost nobody. Because it just has not been widely adopted in this country that people it's natural to them to get out their phone and understand how to scan a QR code and understand what website it will lead you to with all that information. So you were a resistor, Jim, but you managed to master it?
I'm a revolutionary like Roger Berkowitz. What can
I say? That's right. That's right. I always say that about you, too.
Thank you very much. We're talking to Corby Kummer. Should we go out to Minneapolis?
Yes,
I love this story.
You were at this restaurant in Minneapolis.
Well, actually, when Trump was out there for a fundraiser, and by the way, had I been there, I would have gone. It was only $200,000 a couple, which I think for a good meal and to see somebody you admire is there. Can you believe this? This is not a Trump thing. Can you believe this country has laws that allow one couple to give $200,000 to any candidate for anything? I mean, is that obscene or is that obscene? I'm talking to you, Corby Kummer.
Well, if it's for a good steak dinner, it's a little obscene.
Okay. So during the Republican convention, the Sarah Palin Republican convention, I was out there working, obviously. And Michael Graham, remember dear Michael, Marjorie Egan, our colleague?
I certainly do.
At the radio station. And a few of our producers went to Murray's, which I think is one of the most famous steakhouses, Corby, anywhere.
Yeah.
Michael orders the slab bacon appetizer, and I'm raising my right hand so that you know I'm telling the truth. And the slab bacon appetizer comes. It is a one-pound chunk of and the waiter or the server says to me, do you want the medium-sized steak or larger steak? I'll take the larger steak. I said, how many ounces it was? Again, on my honor.
32.
84 ounce.
Come on.
It was like $200, by the way, but the company was paying. Not GBH. Don't get
how
excited.
Big, excuse me. How big is an 84 ounce steak?
It was like a third of the tabletop. It was just It was obscene. But tell what happened after the fact when Donald Trump traveled out to Minneapolis to charge $200,000 the couple.
So this restaurant, a family-owned restaurant since 1946, a Murray's, which is home of the silver butter knife steak, catered this $200,000 a couple, $100,000 a head dinner at the Lake Minnetonka home of Marty Davis, a quartz countertop manufacturer, Cambria. So be careful when you're renovating your kitchen, depending on your political beliefs. They came out, they catered it, they worked the event, and now 13 of them, because they have no idea if they were exposed, even if they were personally removed from the president, they don't know that somebody else in the room wasn't positive. They're all quarantining, so they're losing work for 2 weeks. I hope that Murray's, the family-owned restaurant, is paying them for this work-induced loss of work. But who knows how good restaurants are about that. And that's a really key to my code of conduct, my safety standards, everybody's. If restaurants are really going to be serious about protecting their workers, they have to say, we will pay you if you are feeling ill and you stay home. We need you to stay home if you're feeling ill. Now, side lecture aside, this restaurant exposed its workers because of Trump and his people assuming that the instant tests they took were accurate. That's what's gotten everybody at the White House event, which they won't investigate through contact tracing, into trouble. They believed tests. They didn't believe that there were a lot of false negatives. There are a lot of false negatives. And obviously, these tests are not fail-safe if they're not PCR, which, you know, the great Broad Institute in Cambridge, lots of places are contracting with universities. They are reliable. These were not reliable.
Right.
They were instant tests. They exposed these, you know, poor workers to risk it. Now they're home for they're missing 2 weeks of work.
I'm with you, by the way. If a restaurant did that, well, first of all, they shouldn't do it to begin with. If they did it and they don't do everything in their financial ability to take care of and prospectively to protect these people, then you shouldn't go there. Having said that, let's end like we always do. Winter's coming. Support your local restaurant. Take out, outdoor, whatever you're comfortable with, do it, but support your local restaurant.
Tip big, hey, Corby, be nice.
Amen.
Thank you very
Corby,
much,
it's
Corby.
Great to talk to you.
And you.
Our food man, Corby Kummer, joins us regularly. He's the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Corby, thanks again. Coming up, we're checking in with Callie Crossley, host of Under the Radar. She is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as she does every Friday, is host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. My powers of deduction and beyond suggest it is Callie Crossley. Hello, Callie Crossley. Well, maybe my powers of deduction were wrong. Oh, there she is.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Callie.
Jim.
How
Hi,
are you? Great to talk
hey,
to
Callie.
You.
Yeah, hi.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good.
Well, hanging in. So I wanted to ask you about a little of the news this week. What do you think about the debate, Kamala Harris and Mike versus Mike Pence?
Well, I'm actually, this is my commentary for Monday, but the mansplaining and and then Kamala's really, she had to rein herself in not to just want to reach over there and, you know, or say. I just felt bad that she couldn't be the full expression of her talents, could not be on display because, you know, she'd get the kind of response that she did get anyway when she really tried to sort of tamp down as much as she could her responses because you know what she was going to be called, and she was that. Well, the president,
the angry black woman thing.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
and the president's called her a monster, yeah, as you know. And there was far worse, far worse on online everywhere. So, you know, you. There is nothing. I was so glad that somebody helped media train her to just keep smiling. And inside, I'm thinking she's thinking, "Oh my God."
I thought that was real.
If you don't mind, yes. I found that comment by the president so grotesque. It Do you mind grotesque. If we play it?
Yeah,
only
go
so
right
people
ahead.
Can hear it.
Yeah.
This is Donald Trump, again, doing his analysis. I think it was on Fox Business. I'm not sure. But here he is describing what he thought of the performance of Senator Harris.
I thought that wasn't even a contest last night. She was terrible. She was, I don't think you could get worse, and totally unlikable. And she is. And this monster that was on stage with Mike Pence, who destroyed her last night, by the way, but this monster, she says, no, no, there won't be fracking. There won't be this. There won't. Everything she said is a lie.
There it is.
Oh, my God.
Your president.
You just can't even.
Kelly, I wonder, too, you mentioned the mansplaining thing. I can't help thinking, I don't know if anybody has done polling on this yet, but that there had to be a gender divide
about
the reaction to the debate.
Yes, there was.
Yes, I think a lot of women were like, shut up. And I think a lot of men, because they're talking so much, didn't see any problem.
Yeah, there were focus groups that some of the analysts referred to where, 64% of women were like, she was fine, she was good, and the men were like, nah, she was a shrew, she was that, she was that. Because you can't open your mouth and be articulate and calm and knowledgeable and present yourself on a national platform without some people being offended. It's so disheartening that some of these sexist norms are so deeply rooted that we just can't get past them in any circumstance. It's really hard.
By the way, beyond just the monster comment, on Laura Ingraham's show, there's some presidential surrogate who describes Harris as Hillary in blackface. And as horrible as that is, I immediately look up when I hear that. What was Laura Ingraham's response? Mm-hmm. She said, and he says it's all over Twitter. Her response is that right? Wow.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just, and again, it is fine. It is. You can support whoever you want in any race, and politics ain't beanbag, as they say. But these comments are so nauseating and so just racist and disgusting. It is just, it's amazing to me that people can.
Well, two things need to be noted there. Daryl Scott is black.
That's who it is, right?
Right, yeah, and he's one of the circle around President Trump who've been there since 2016. He's on the paid circle. Let's make sure we're clear. But I guess he has drunk the Kool-Aid and everything else. But for her to not respond and say, listen, I don't like the woman. That's not my politics. But you're not going to go there with me on that. You're not going to say that on my show. And what would that have taken? She who wears a cross around her neck every night.
Oh, doesn't that Marjorie's drive
me nuts? Drives me nuts. Absolutely.
Callie,
so many of these women wear crosses around their neck.
Callie, we try every Friday to sort of coast into the weekend with an occasional thing that is not quite as heavy. So can we spend 30 seconds on our favorite topic of the last 24 hours? What do you think of the fly on the head?
Well, it was so. So I started watching it as everybody else did, and I'm thinking, why doesn't it move? And Nicole Wallace answered the question because she said, this just lets you know how very much he did not move, that he had no animation. She said, what fly do you know will sit still on your head for 2 minutes? You have to move.
That's
people
true.
Just move. You would just do it inadvertently. And she says, so for that fly to sit there, that's how still he was. Now, other people online haven't been so kind. They say it was, the whatever hairspray he was using.
That's what Chuck Todd said to us yesterday. He thought it was the hairspray too, by the way.
And the fly couldn't get out except after 2 minutes of trying. So,
by the way, I don't know if you've heard. Have you heard this soon-to-be smash hit from Jay Diggs called Fly On You? If you haven't,
no.
Here it is. Fly On You, courtesy of Jay Diggs. Here it is.
You better fly on you.
My God.
A little more. You're going nowhere. You're getting comfy. He's just chilling in your hair. You might be all he needs.
Jay Diggs. I mean, people can come up with stuff
in
a minute. I tell you.
Well, he, as brilliant was in about a nanosecond, the Biden campaign has the fly swatter. And what was the slogan? Truth over flies, which I thought was pretty crazy.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy.
There's another one with buds off, too, that I guess are all sold out. And,
yeah, this is sold out.
But
too.
I, of course, love the T-shirts that have been created. Mr. President, I'm speaking.
That was a great moment, too.
So
let's talk a little bit about South Carolina. I think for lots of people, this was a total shocker. Lindsey Graham, who obviously has done a lot of about-facing when it comes to Donald Trump, is in a tight race with Jamie Harrison.
Yes.
And who's, I've seen him on TV a few times. He's a very impressive guy.
But he's a newcomer.
Yeah, totally newcomer.
I mean, he is known in the state. He's a South Carolina native, attended Yale, Georgetown Law, chairman of the state's Democratic Party. But when we say newcomer, I mean, you know, he's not run for office in this way. And then to run for office against somebody who has a long reputation and a long tenure in South Carolina, as we know that Lindsey Graham has. So the Cook Political Report, which is a nonpartisan political newsletter, moved the rating from lean Republican, which is how they had assessed, you know, which way the state might go or the vote might go, to toss up, which means that Lindsey Graham and Jamie Harrison, a newcomer, a black newcomer, are in a dead heat for Lindsey Graham's seat at this moment, which is amazing. And it's gotten to the point, it's so scary to Lindsey Graham. He's been going on all kinds of conservative radio and TV and begging people to send him money so that he can fight Jamie Harrison.
You know, several interesting things. One, I think they're supposed to debate tonight, and now it's in doubt because Lindsey Graham, I assume for ideological reasons, refuses to take a COVID-19 test. Beforehand.
What is the ideological reason there?
We don't need tests. I don't know. You just tough it through, or I don't know. Why else wouldn't you do it? But, you know, the interest that we're going to carry the hearings, the Coney Barrett hearings live here next week, Callie. And they're not only high stakes for Coney Barrett. And by the way, not something else that broke during our show is she gave two speeches to two anti-abortion groups
that
were not reported on the form she submitted, the Senate form. Mm. But it seems to me that Lindsey Graham's – it's a dead heat, as you say. Lindsey Graham's future is dependent upon how people – see him. He's the chair of the Judiciary Committee. So the stakes are not only high for Trump and Barrett, they are incredibly high for Lindsey Graham, no?
Yeah, they're very much high. And Harrison has been focusing on Graham's attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So all of this is, you know, full circle in a way. So you're not going to take a test, supporting legislation that would have knocked 21 million Americans off their insurance. What's that about? What about these pre-existing conditions, which you know are not taken care of? So that's what's helped him also gain some momentum, which, by the way, if people think back to 2018, that was the singular focus of a lot of folks in the Democratic sweep that happened during that primary election. So his not taking a test, I don't get that.
Well, I don't know either.
But I don't even understand that.
I hope I don't want to be unfair here because I literally read it in the 1 minute in between segments. So there may be some other rationale. If there is, I'm sure one of our colleagues will share it with us in a couple of seconds. By the way, if I can say to the people in the control room, Marjorie appears to have lost sound. So if somebody can get on this while Callie and I continue our conversation. Callie, if Facebook, Zuckerberg, who I think is – I don't know if he's sensitive to – well, he is sensitive to – I don't know about his response – to their political advertising decisions, has decided that they'll halt political ads at least for the week after the election. I assume that's in reaction to the notion that there's likely to be a huge amount of conflict about vote counts starting on November 3rd. Is that right?
Yeah, but help me understand. Am I missing something? The election, at least the vote, at that point will be over. People have been voting now, as you know, and will vote up until that day. The count will start, But there's no more voting. So why are we running the political ads? Help me. Well, I'm not understanding.
Because I think there's going to be a bit – I'm guessing. I surely don't speak for Zuckerberg. I assume there's going to be a huge political battle. I mean, we discussed on the show before the so-called red mirage.
Right.
That unless it is an overwhelming victory for Biden, the likelihood is good that Trump leads on opening night because a larger percentage of his voters, November 3rd, larger percentage of his voters are going to vote in person, so it'll be counted faster, and that lead will start narrowing, if not maybe even disappear, as mail-in votes are counted. And we assume that Trump's strategic decision, if what I just described is true, is to declare victory on Monday night, and then it becomes a political battle. And he said during the Coney Barrett nomination process that one of the reasons he wanted her confirmed before Election Day was, and these are his own words, because he assumes the Supreme Court will be deciding the election. And even though theoretically they're above politics, I think we know in this century that the court is never – no court – well, not no court. The Supreme Court is never above politics anymore. So I'm guessing that's the rationale, don't you think?
It doesn't make any sense to me, because if that's – so all the ads would be directed at the nine people on the court at that point?
Well, I mean, no. I think pressure – I would assume pressure – because the reality is when – I'm sure you've done this too. When you read books on the Supreme Court, to suggest that they don't in highly charged matters – put their finger to the wind to see where the political current is naive.
Right.
And I think that matters if it where the American populace is on this thing. And by the way, Facebook also, even if this is a wise decision, this is the same place that wanted credit when they decided to kill political ads for a week before the election. The problem is people were voting, are voting, as you say, already.
Yes.
So why aren't they killing political ads other than for financial reasons right now?
This is what that's what I was confused by. Like this, I don't understand what this move means. And by the way, I don't understand why people would be advertising either after the date of when the final votes are in. I just don't get it. But okay, I'm happy for them to remove anything that just causes more consternation because, you know, as we know, this is a very volatile time. So anything that can bring the temperature down, that's fine. I'm just not understanding what their move is.
Well, we'll try to figure that out in a second. By the way, in fairness to Senator Graham, even though I think this is not much of an excuse, in a statement, his campaign said, "I took a COVID-19 test last week after a Judiciary Committee hearing." Well, that was last week.
Yeah.
And as there's another day and another day, and you're going to be with senators and already two members of your committee, Senators Lee and I think is it Tillis? Yes,
Tillis
are both on the Judiciary Committee, and both are COVID positive. So,
and both of them have said they will be at the hearing. So there you go. And Jamie Harrison was the one that insisted, I guess, in the previous debate that there be plexiglass between them. And he said, "I don't really care what anybody thinks about it, but I have to think about my family and, you know, my grandmother, my wife, my kids. I'm taking all precautions I need to take, whether or not you agree."
By the way, one thing that I will, since I'm being critical of Facebook, one thing they're also announced they're doing that I think is good is, let me read it, is they'll remove calls for people to engage in poll watching when those calls use militarized language or suggest the goal is to intimidate, exert control, or display power over election officials or voters. Obviously, in response to the president saying he was urging people, this is a week or so ago,
right,
urging people to do very, you know, go to the polls and very carefully watch what is going on there. We're talking to Kelly Crossey. The reason you're not hearing Marjorie is not because I'm talking over her, as usual, but because her sound has died. They're working on it as we speak, and Kelly and I will continue. So, you know, I have to be careful saying this. I am among those, and I know this aggravates a lot of people out there. I don't want to see anything horrible happen to anybody. I like elections, and Marjorie's on the phone now. That's great.
Okay.
I like elections to be making decisions, but I have to say there is some justice when the head of that mega church, I think in San Antonio, that was suing schools because they weren't reopening fast enough, who has a bad word to say about virtually anything, and also thought that the COVID thing was wildly overblown. What happened to this 80-year-old patriarch of that megachurch?
Diagnosed with COVID-19.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there he is. And by the way, he has the mega church, as you mentioned, with 22,000 members who he is not encouraging to follow the state's mandate. And this is Texas. So Governor Abbott is saying, well, we try to tell churches, you know, but if they don't follow it, we don't make anything big out of it. So they just allow these people to go in and not socially distance and not wear masks or whatever. So God knows how many people this man has been in contact with. And as you pointed out, he decided he would, you know, leverage his capital, his social capital in that community to sue the schools because other people, he's 80 years old, his kids are grown, you know, are feeling uncomfortable about whether or not they want to send their kids back to school. So there you go.
Kelly, do you want to take a call? We have a call from Marjorie from Brookline.
Yes.
Marjorie, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Well, I don't know if you guys mentioned this when I couldn't hear you, but did you mention this guy called Katrina, a judgment from God for the sins of New Orleans? Yeah.
Yes,
I mean, he's a little bit out there.
He's very much, well, he also called the Roman Catholic Church a false cult system. So
False cult system.
So you can kind of see where he's going, where he's coming from, you know.
So, by the way, this is your first-time caller. You're doing excellent on your first call, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm surprised that the phone worked.
What took you so long to call the show? Are you a fan of the show or you're not?
Well, I was trying futilely, obviously, to fix my home technology. I could not seem to fix it, Jim, so... That was my next approach. I thought that was a good approach. John called me, actually. John McLaw Parker called me, and here we are.
Okay.
So speaking of justice, before you tell us what you're doing this weekend, the McCloskeys have got to get a lawyer out there in St. Louis. Is that correct?
Yep. The McCloskeys, people may remember, Mark and Patricia were the ones who pulled out their guns at protesters who were, you know, doing marches through the neighborhood. They said they felt threatened or whatever. And anyway, they now face two counts each for exhibiting a weapon and tampering with evidence. The reporters don't know what the tampering part means. That's not been revealed, but they definitely are going to have to face a jury or face a grand jury. I guess there's evidence that's been presented to a grand jury to get the tampering charge so that is a real charge. That's not somebody thinking they did it. And the statement charged a couple saying they waved weapons in a threatening manner at those participating in a nonviolent protest. And went on to say, we are fortunate this situation did not escalate into deadly force because this type of conduct is unacceptable in St. Louis. So we'll see what happens, but that's where they are. By the way, they live down the street or in the same neighborhood with the St. Louis mayor, Lyda Crewson. And she decided after what the time frame was, that she would release the names and home addresses of the defund the police activists. So it's just a great neighborhood in general, it looks like.
You know, Kelly, before we do find out what you're doing, while you were speaking, I was just looking at the Facebook story to see what is the rationale for killing ads in the week after. And I think we focused, or at least I focused, too much on the presidential election, potentially ending in the Supreme Court. Their concern, at least one of their concerns, is what happens closer to home if the declared winner of a race is contested by another candidate. And then there becomes, you know, obviously much closer to the ground level when local elected officials and others, I guess, is the thinking, are much more sensitive to public opinion. So I guess their view is that killing ads for that week will be a positive thing, even though it would have been much more positive if they'd killed the ads for the month or so before the election. Go ahead, Marjorie. I'm sorry.
A quick question. I was just checking my email. I'm not sure if this is correct, but you both may know better than I do. This emailer says that Lindsey Graham is not taking a COVID test to be consistent with other GOP senators who are not taking tests either to assure that the Coney Barrett hearings go forward. Did you hear anything about that?
No,
well, we didn't know why he wasn't doing it. We just think it's weird that he's not, particularly since two of his colleagues are positive and have already said they're coming back to be a part of the discussion no matter what.
So in any case, Kelly, what are you doing Sunday night? Hopefully you're not doing your show on the phone, but whatever you're doing, what are you doing?
We have another edition of our environmental roundtable. We're talking about wildfires in New Hampshire. people are focusing on California, which is proper, but there's a great potential here in New England, and New Hampshire is one of the places. We're also looking at Boston winning a top spot in the annual Clean Energy City Report, which is a good thing. The controversy of the Roxbury residents fighting for their trees and how that has spanned out into a broader based
fight.
Yeah,
good.
And it's real, it's a lot of good conversation around that. And also a very thoughtful look at what public land management will look like under either a Trump presidency, the continuation of a Trump presidency, or a Biden presidency. Then for segment B, we are driving the points home on the yes and no big battle over quote unquote right to repair. Ballot question number one. We're looking under the hood, giving you all the facts, doing it again, because it just is so confusing. And I don't know if you all know that in 2002, when the first right to repair bill was voted in, it is the highest voted on ballot question ever in Massachusetts history. So there's a great amount of interest. There's also a lot of confusion about this and a lot of money involved on both sides.
Let me just tell you something. If you're going to fully explain question two, and I love when the ads are juxtaposed on television right next to each other, you're going to need a 6-hour program. So I will tell, in all seriousness, I will not miss it because I thought I knew what my position was. And I, too, even though I used to do ballot campaigns for a living, I am totally confused. So I will be there.
You mean a question one. You said question two.
Two is the ranked choice thing, which we'll discuss in a day.
You're confused on the
right to repair.
Yes. Yeah. Whether it's really about – the focus is data. That's what I'll give you the head. Data and telematics. And there – so we're breaking it all down.
Okay. Well, as soon as we find out what telematics are, we'll be listening.
That's why you have to listen.
Exactly. Callie, thank you. Bo, don't go away. We have more of the statement from Lindsey Graham.
Oh.
Is any other Southeast Carolinian demanding that every person, I assume Harrison said he wanted him tested, that every person they come in contact with be tested before they meet? Do workers in South Carolina demand their coworkers and customers be tested before going to work? Do restaurants demand their coworkers and customers be tested before being allowed to dine? So I was essentially right. This is a sort of a libertarian, you're not telling me what to do kind of thing. So even if it will mean that everybody around me will be safer.
And by the way, the answer is yes to that.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
So what is he talking about? Yes.
Hey, Callie, yeah. We'll be listening. Okay. Thanks. It's really good to talk to you.
All
thanks
right.
so much.
Take care.
Marjorie,
thank you very much.
After you say what time Callie's show is, I have a suggestion for the last few minutes.
Oh, okay. Callie Crossey is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossey, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. Subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes. Follow her on Twitter at Callie Crossey. What are you going to tell me, Jim?
I think we should talk about The Fly. We only have 4 or 5 minutes left, and it was the biggest story of the week, let's face it, and it's Friday afternoon.
Okay.
So when we come back, we'll play a little bit more from that fabulous song, and we'll discuss with you very briefly The Fly. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And we had something else we wanted to talk about, but since we ran a little bit over, the mayor was kind enough to stick around for a few minutes, and we wanted to talk to Callie and Corby, obviously. We only have a few minutes, so we thought we'd entertain reflections on The Fly. I mean, it is true. You know, it is a pathetic state of affairs that the most talked about social media about aspect of the Harris-Pence-Paul debate was the 2-minute appearance by The Fly. Do you have any reflections? Because we're going to play the music again in a minute.
Well, I'm just stealing stuff. I'm reading online. Apparently, fans want Jeff Goldblum to play The Fly.
Exactly.
On Saturday Night Live. The Lincoln Project, there are a bunch of Republicans who do not like the president. Steve Schmidt from the Lincoln Project, I believe. So.
Yeah.
He said The Fly on Pence's head is historically a mark of the devil. And there's all sorts of people taking off about how Pence and Harris and The Fly scored in the debate. So there's a lot of stuff online.
You know what?
I see some great stuff on Twitter.
I said this yesterday, too, when we had Chuck Todd on. Were you thinking when you were watching it, are Harris or Susan Page going to say something? I mean, it was sort of weird. They knew it was there, too. And aren't they sitting there thinking, do I say something? Do I make a joke? Am I serious? Do I do a kindness to Mike Pence and say, Mr. Vice President, there's a fly on your head? And I mean, whatever.
You would in a normal situation, wouldn't you? I mean, it's like what you said the other day. Suppose he came in with a pants fly down.
Well, I think that's a little bit different. I think if your fly was down, Marjorie, I think someone would probably give you an indication
maybe
you should deal with it.
Maybe not. Maybe she would want him to do the entire debate with his fly down. I don't know.
Here's Michelle in Sturbridge with her thought on the fly. Welcome to the show, Michelle. Hi.
Thank you. I think it's a first-time caller. I love you, Shel.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. We all need a good laugh nowadays. I think it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg sitting there trying to, make it light of this whole situation. And maybe he didn't even notice. So obviously, Kamala noticed. Kamala,
she did.
She noticed. So, it just... I still think Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to come back in various incarnations.
And that was one. That's fair enough. Hey, Michelle, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you very much.
What is that guy's name? Is it Jay Diggs? Is that what the guy's name is? Is it Jay Diggs? Okay, can we hear that one more time? Because I really loved it. This is Jay Diggs. And what's it called? Fly on Me, Fly on You. Here it is. You know what's amazing about this, by the way? Everything is so uptight in American politics today. You know what would humanize Mike Pence? Because he is a little stiff. I think even people who love him would say he's not a loose kind of politician. He should make jokes.
Fly jokes?
He should be making the jokes about the fly on his head, no?
He should be making jokes about the. I mean, I don't. Has he even mentioned it? I'm not. I don't know.
He gave a big speech as a surrogate for the president, who obviously is not out on the campaign trail. And by the way, speaking of reversing himself, just to bring people up to speed, mm-hmm. Donald Trump, whose doctor apparently will say anything he wants him to say, said he was ready to go out on the campaign trail. Big rally tomorrow night. Apparently, Meadows and others are saying that the logistics might not quite be ready. Which means they were not. And the question that's asked again, in light of the fact that we're getting such little information from the doctors, is he medically ready to go out on the campaign trail? Very quickly, if I can't, you want to take Brendan from Boston in 30 seconds? You have 30 seconds, Brendan. Take it away. Go.
I just wanted to quickly say I'm really excited to vote for Kamala Harris, but if it was a choice between Mike Pence and the fly, I would vote fly.
Oh, well, that's an honest answer. Thank you. Brendan, thank you for your call. We got to go, Marjorie. There's no more fly talk.
Oh, we do have to go. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you for tuning in this week. On Monday, we're going to have special coverage of the Senate confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. We're going to do what we usually do, take all your calls and impressions whenever they have any breaks in the action. They usually do. We want to thank our crew. Chelsea Murs, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubley, Aidan Conley. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. The engineers who keep our remote studios running are Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein. Many people are insisting via email, Jim, that Lindsey Graham is not taking the test because the Republicans want to make sure no one else is eliminated from being involved in the Judiciary Committee hearings or the vote.
Well, that may be one reason. You know what another reason is? The president will not say when he tested negative prior to testing positive. If he's taken a test in the last few days and you don't upstage, I guess, the head of your party. I don't understand it, but that's, I guess, the way it is.
And maybe over the weekend we can get to the bottom of why the fly was on his head for so long, because you're right. Flies don't usually stick around, Jim, but that fly was stuck. And that's why he was sticking around.
And by the way, Marjorie's sound will be fixed by Monday. And I want to reiterate what Marjorie says. Not only will we be carrying the hearing, but different from everybody else who is, whenever there's a break in the hearing, and there are plenty, we will take all your calls on an incredibly important nomination that could change the course of history for decades to come. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan-Yadido, what Jim said, and thanks for listening. I hope you can listen again on Monday. Bye-bye.